We'll hear a lawyer's view on the case and on free speech in general. The GCSE pass rates are low this year and particularly bad for certain sections of society. We'll delve into why and talk to our US correspondent for the latest from there. But first, Rachel Reeves is planning a mansion tax, which has been received with the inevitable whining from those inside those mansions. The money's got to come from somewhere. Should tax only be paid by those of us who can least afford it? That and more with me, Nick Abbott, after the new news at 10 on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, the government has taken control of the UK's third largest steel company to try to save hundreds of jobs. The High Court's confirmed that Speciality Steel, previously part of Liberty Steel, faces compulsory liquidation. LBC's Yorkshire correspondent Alex Taylor-Brown has the details.
Around 1,500 people are employed across the two Liberty Steel sites in Rotherham and in Stocksbridge, just outside Sheffield. It's understood an insolvency court's now issued a winding up order for Speciality Steels UK, with the business owing hundreds of millions to creditors.
Israel's Prime Minister says he's ordered talks to end the war with Hamas and free the hostages still in Gaza. But Benjamin Netanyahu stressed any conclusion must be acceptable to his country. In a separate development, the Foreign Office has summoned Israel's ambassador to the UK after plans were approved to effectively cut off the occupied West Bank from East Jerusalem. A man's been charged with the murder of an ice cream seller near Wembley Stadium. Shahzad Khan, who was 41, was stabbed during an argument on Tuesday night. Police say 26-year-old Zahar Zarour, who's also accused of possessing a bladed article, will appear in court tomorrow. A woman jailed for stirring up racial hatred on the day of the Southport stabbings has been released from prison after serving a third of her sentence. 42-year-old Lucy Connolly, who's the wife of a Conservative councillor, was jailed for 31 months in October. She called for people to set fire to hotels housing asylum seekers in a post online in July last year. Tom Slater edits the website Spiked and told LBC, in his view, her release is overdue.
I am very much in the camp that she shouldn't really have been in prison in the first place. Whilst this tweet in particular is really edging up towards, I think, anyone's line where freedom of speech is concerned, this was undoubtedly vile and inflammatory and so on. I think that we shouldn't be putting people in prison for things that they say in the heat of the moment.
And members of the RMT union on the London Underground have announced a series of strikes next month. They'll walk out at different times for 7 days from the 5th of September in a row over pay and conditions. In the city, the FTSE 100 has closed up 21 points at 93.09. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.15. LBC weather, a largely dry and clear night with a few patches of cloud. Thicker cloud developing from the west in the early hours, a low of 5 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Daryl Jackson.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Good evening. In a different but related topic to the one that Ian was just talking about, Rachel Reeves has been warned that a mansion tax risks backfiring and could raise little or even no money. Andrew Wishart, an economist at an institution called Berenberg Bank, which, if you have not heard of it, is not for you, said a raid on wealthy homeowners could ultimately fail to raise the money she needs. Let's talk about this with Stephen Barber. Stephen is a political economist and professor of global affairs at the University of East London. Joins us on the line now. Hello, Stephen.
Good evening.
It seems like whatever tax on the wealthy the government suggests, there's a representative of the wealthy that insists it won't work. Private schools, VAT, the farm landowners' inheritance tax, non-DOMs, I could go on. Do you think they do protest too much?
Well, I mean, I think we're in a position here where the Chancellor's first budget a year ago made some unpopular decisions, including the national insurance rise, which it viewed at the time, I think, very much as a necessary evil. It needed to stabilise public finances. And they intended that to be very much a one-off, not to be repeated. And she didn't expect to be here a year later, you know, looking again for ways of plugging our budget, but that's where they are for various reasons. And I'd say, actually, for many reasons, many of them completely out of the control of the government, in fairness. So it's looking around for ways of raising additional income to address the public finances. It's not necessarily looking for ways of, you know, attacking the rich or anything like that.
But that's how the rich are taking it.
Maybe. I think this particular proposal, when you look at main residence capital gains tax, the relief there theoretically costs the Treasury about $31 billion a year. So you can see why it might be tempting. But I think this is probably kite-flying by the government. My instinct is this is a change that won't happen because of those unintended consequences, you know, that you would maybe not grind to a halt, but you certainly see Trump action slowing very dramatically, and that would be counterproductive to what the government wants to achieve. Not least because it would also it would make downsizing near impossible, something that the British housing market particularly needs, given the misallocation of housing. It would make moving home to similar value homes near impossible. And even when you're limiting to expensive properties, $1.5 million, you would probably cause something of a stall in the housing market chain. So I think they'll probably look elsewhere.
Well, yeah, that's the reason given by this economist at Berenberg Bank, that this won't work because people will delay a sale and wait for what another government does. That's not really how people organise their lives, though, is it?
Well, people are incentivised by the way that they are taxed. And you could imagine that this, you would have to have a very substantial profit within the house to justify to yourself moving, given that you would probably also have to pay the stamp duty on a purchase. So it would have those unintended consequences. I think for those reasons, I think the Treasury will probably rule it out.
But it would only have consequences to a very small number of people. I mean, the idea is to charge capital gains tax on the sale of homes worth over £1.5 million. Now, there's about 340,000 homes in the whole of the UK that are worth that. It's the top 2% of the market. And it's only taxed on the value above £1.5 million. And the capital gains tax rate is half the rate of earned income. So it wouldn't affect 98% of the population. Most people would still keep almost all of the increase in the value of their homes. It doesn't sound unreasonable.
Well, what you would end up having is, of course, those properties that are around the threshold mark. You would see those properties becoming much, much harder to sell. Probably at the very high end, but many times more than that, it would have less of an impact. But, of course, just because it's only those properties, it doesn't mean it doesn't affect the rest of the housing chain. And you see housing chain then coming right the way down to much more modest house sales. So you would see that coming back through a chain. And slowing down the housing market, of course, isn't something that the government wants.
I fail to see how it would slow down the market if it only applies to 2% of the homes available.
Well, because those 2% are part of the housing chain that relates to the other 98% in a sense. As you come down the housing chain, you have people moving up and indeed down that chain. So if you stop or slow down sales at one end of the chain, it will have an impact all the way down to more modest.
But surely a very, very small impact, because if only 2% of houses are affected by this, and a large percentage of the people that might be selling those homes will do so regardless. I fail to see how that is going to materially affect the bottom 98% who will be selling homes that aren't anywhere near £1.5 million.
Because of the nature of a housing chain, I think is the point about it. Because the sale at the top then comes down to the sale below that and below that and below that, and it comes right down the chain. And the whole UK housing market is a series of complex changes, as anyone who has the misfortune of experiencing moving house will realize. You're working up and down the chain. So I mean, I think the government will look elsewhere, but of course there the pickings are slim. Then they may look at other ways of accessing the wealth tied up in property.
I'm sure whatever they suggest is going to be met with the same wave of whining. I mean, do you think that it really will stop people downsizing in old age, or would they likely be unaffected? Because people will still want less space in old age, and they'll still want the cash just as they do now. So they'll sell regardless.
If you look at, I'm not a housing expert, but if you look at housing in the UK, one of the problems about housing is that we have a misallocation. Is that you have people perhaps whose family have flown the nest, who are then sitting on larger properties with spare rooms, with then younger families who are unable to access those. So one of the ways of tackling the housing crisis that we have at the moment is that you encourage downsizing at different life stages. And of course, if you're liable to a tax, a substantial tax potentially on the profits, it will of course disincentivize people from doing that. And again, you're back in the chain. So I suspect the government will look at other ways of perhaps accessing that wealth. That they see a huge amount of wealth tied up in property in the UK, and of course it's there. And perhaps the other way of doing it is to have a squeeze on inheritance tax allowances, another way of accessing it, but in a way that doesn't sort of interfere in such an acute way with the housing market.
Those representing the wealthy always say that a wealth tax, separate to the property tax that we're talking about, a wealth tax has never worked anywhere. But am I not right in thinking Norway, Spain, Switzerland, Colombia, France, Italy, Belgium, Luxembourg all apply a wealth tax of some sort? If it works there, why not here?
Well, when we're talking about sort of kite flying, of course, the idea of a wealth tax was something that the government was floating a couple of weeks ago, and we've moved from that to this idea of a capital gains tax. It's very similar reasons that they probably moved on, which is, for a start, it would probably end up being a tax on London. They haven't proved massively successful elsewhere, and actually, if you look over the last 30-odd years of wealth taxes internationally, there's a decreasing number of countries that have employed them. So it's pretty much halved, I think, the amount of countries that are now using wealth taxes. But not a particularly efficient way for the government to raise the revenue that it requires. Although, of course, when you listen to what the Treasury is saying, it's saying, of course, that there's a lot of wealth tied up in the likes of property and assets that it hasn't been able to access. So it's probably looking for more subtle ways of accessing that wealth.
But do you think there's any, excuse me, do you think there is any justification for the appreciation in value of one asset, homes, being taxed at zero, while other assets are charged capital gains tax?
Obviously, if you own a second property, that is subject to capital gains tax. So it's only the principal private residence that is exempt from or has that allowance from CGT. And it's for those reasons of allowing people to move to participate in the housing market without that huge cost with a move. I mean, there is of course stamp duty. So you pay stamp duty on the purchase. This would be an additional charge on the sale. So when you're looking at that. you could imagine that, that you'd have to have a substantial profit to justify any move if you were paying both a capital gains tax on the sale of the property and also a stamp duty on the purchase of the new one. You'd have to have enough to cover both of those things. And that's the principal reason.
Well, similarly, do you think there's any justification for wealth accrued through the appreciation in the value of assets to be charged at half the rate of tax of earned income?
I mean, I think there's a very good argument for looking at that. The idea that, that we tax work higher than we tax some more passive incomes. Again, you've got to be careful of the unintended consequences of some of those things. You can actually increase risk taking within capital markets, which is something that you perhaps don't want to do. I think in many ways the fairest tax, the one that's most related to the ability to pay, is of course income tax, and that would be I think in many ways the fairest way of addressing the problem that the government finds itself with at the moment. For political reasons, of course, it's ruled out. And again, I wouldn't be too critical of the government for this, because I think no party's been elected to office for half a century when going into the election promising to raise taxes and to raise direct income taxes. So it's a very difficult position to be in politically. But that would be the fairest way of addressing it.
No, surely the fairest way would be to tax wealth, because a billionaire does not become a billionaire by dint of earning a wage. They become a billionaire because of the appreciation in the value of their assets. That's where the money is.
There's certainly a moral argument for that. I think in very pragmatic terms, the Treasury looks at the likelihood of a tax raising the revenues that it requires. The problem with wealth taxes on the very wealthy, and I think you're talking there about the kind of super rich, if you like, is that it's very easy for the super rich to move assets in a way that makes them not subject to tax.
Well, yes, but only because the government allows them to do so. I mean, it's very easy to kill somebody, but that doesn't mean to say that we should make murder legal. Surely something can be done about it. I mean, other countries charge a stern exit tax if somebody wants to drain the wealth that has been made in a country that has been, that has been paid for. The benefits of being in that country has been paid for by all of that country's taxpayers.
You could look at things like that. I mean, we haven't had them in this country for more than four decades. Those kind of exchange controls, where you were limited how much cash you could take out of the country. That again obviously has real implications for how you're running the economy and foreign direct investment and businesses setting up in a country. If you can't move funds in and out in a free way, you're going to disincentivize those, and those will also undermine government's attempts to kickstart growth, which it desperately needs to do.
There's always this always seems to be an excuse to prevent the rich from paying their fair share. It's just excruciating. It's everything the government suggests, there's always a reason why they can't do it.
Well, I mean, I think the government's in a difficult position, and I think if the answer to these things was easy, they would just be done. The Treasury, I think, is relatively pragmatic in looking at the range of levers that it has, and it wants to pull the levers that are going to be effective at both stabilising public finances, but also supporting the economy to be in a position of longer-term economic growth. I think most of these decisions would be much easier if the economy was growing at kind of 3% rather than the 1.5% that it is at the moment.
I know that the mantra from the government is growth, 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 but the wealth is already here. We're continually told we're the sixth richest country in the world, and yet much of the population is worried about putting food on the table. It's not growth that's the thing. It's a fairer distribution of wealth, surely.
Well, the problem with the British economy is that we've had pretty much anemic growth since the global financial crisis of a decade and a half ago. The economy grew 10 times as fast in the 16 years before than the 16 years since. Growth typically was around 3.5% a year. It's been barely 1.5%.
Well, yeah, but that hasn't prevented the rich from becoming ever more spectacularly rich. CEOs of major FTSE 100 companies used to earn 20 times the average wage of their average employee. Now it's getting on for 200 times. So the wealth has been made, right enough, but most of the people in the country have not benefited from that. It's the distribution that's the problem, surely.
The problem is precisely that the most people in the country, or many people in the country, haven't benefited from the economy over the past sort of 15 or 16 years.
So do you not think that if there was more growth, this magical growth was visited upon us, that it would still not trickle down? It would all that growth, all of the wealth that's created, would still stay right at the top with the same people who've got it now?
The growth that we have now, and you can look at a whole range of measures. You can look at the overall growth of the economy. You can look at GDP per person. You can look at real wages, and all of those things are too weak. People across the country will only feel wealthier if they're getting paid more, if the economy is growing, if the organisations that they're working for are being successful, and that's not just in London, the South East. That's got to be right across the country. So the problem with the economy is one of productivity growth. It is one of output, and that's the main challenge that the government has to tackle.
Good to talk to you, Stephen. Thanks for that. Stephen Barber, political economist, professor of global affairs at the University of East London. So what do you make of that, specifically this idea of a mansion tax that Rachel Reeves has suggested? 0345 6060 973.
This is LBC. Listen on the move with the all-new LBC app. Download it for free from the App Store.
This is what award-winning customer service sounds like from Real Octopus Energy Calls.
I've dealt with many utility companies for many years across several properties, and Octopus are an absolute breath of fresh air.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running.
Who's a good human? Jenny is, because Jenny will always do what's best for Bertie, her bestie Bassett. So if Bertie needs to go and wee, that's what they're going to do. Even if it is 3 a.m. and it's raining cat lots. That's why she also chooses Butternut Box for Bertie's meals. Freshly prepared, served straight from the fridge, and conveniently delivered right to your door. At a time that suits you for once. Hey, Jenny. Ready to join thousands of good humans? Go to butternutbox.com to fetch 25% off your first box with code GOODHUMAN.
There now follows a message from the Prime Minister.
Some of you may know, my husband is being held hostage. They are targeting me. They have weaponized my family. I will not be threatened. My loyalties are to this country. I will not allow it to be held to ransom. And anyone who thinks that I would has badly underestimated me.
Hostage, starring Saran Jones, now playing only on Netflix.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So, I guess, in essence, the question is, should we be taxing the rich more? They do complain, right enough, very, very loudly, and they have all of the mass media at their disposal to tell us that what looks like it would be good for the rest of us actually won't be. And everything that has been suggested has been met with the howls of outrage. Private school VAT, the farm landowners' inheritance tax, the non-DOMs, I mean, on and on and on. Everything that the government suggests, just asking those who have been the luckiest among us to put up just a little bit more, wouldn't affect their lifestyles, is impossible. Can't be done. They'll leave, they say. Well, will they? Would the property tax affect the desire for the rich to live here? Are people really going to decide en masse that London, probably the greatest city in the world, particularly for people with money, is not an attractive place to be anymore? They're not interested in the theatres and the restaurants and the parks and the good climate that we have here and the access to Europe and the private schools and the stability of the country and an ordered society and in the and being in an English-speaking country and on and on and on. I don't believe it for a second. Holland Park. Hello, Nick.
Hi, Nick. Do you mind if I start with a minor quibble, which is in your trailer at the end of Ian's show, you asked the question, is this socialism gone mad? And I want to say it's some kind of oxymoron because socialism is mad. It can't go mad. It's mad from the beginning.
Right. Which aspect of socialism are you referring to?
Well, this particular thread that we're talking about now. Now, well,
the distribution of wealth. That's mad.
Well, no, but to the extent at which the government doesn't understand how best to raise as much money as they can. I have this theory, but please bear with me, that we're at something called maximum tax. I think that any of the government, even the Conservatives, of course, they put up taxes a lot, would raise taxes where they could if they would raise more money. I genuinely think, and I'm not saying please, it's not
let me just interject one moment. Please don't say the phrase Laffer curve.
I'm not going to use that.
Good.
But I have my own Holland Park curve, and I'm not leaving the country. You know, my kids and grandkids live here. I love being here. I'm close to the epicenter of the world, which is the LBC studio in Leicester Square. It's great. But my behaviour, like everyone, I don't think it's the super rich that are even necessarily, and their tax avoidance is the biggest thing. We all avoid tax. We're all involved. And
I'm not sure that's true. Who's the we in that sentence? Well, I don't avoid tax. What are you talking about?
I double dare you to say you've never paid a tradesperson in cash.
That's not me avoiding tax. What they do with the money that they ask for is completely up to them.
It is, because you get a discount because you're not paying VAT and never paid. I'm just saying that everyone is involved in it. And I'm involved in tax avoidance. It's completely legal, but my tax avoidance is behavioural. There are a number of things I'd like to do. I own a couple of properties. I'd like to sell them. I'd like to move on and invest in something else. But I don't do it because of the current levels of tax, before even any more tax has been put on. And it's this fiscal drag that's happening millions, I mean millions of times over, and it's not people like me. I'm not rich. I live in Holland Park, but I'm no way rich. But
you live in Holland Park and you have two other properties. That sounds pretty rich to me.
I'm genuinely not. I work like a dog, Nick. I'm sitting at my computer working now, taking the time off to call you. But the point is, everyone's behaviour is affected, and I genuinely think we are at maximum tax. There's nothing the government can put the tax up on that doesn't either get less tax. Witness the non-DOMS thing. The Treasury have said 2 months ago, after the non-DOM rules were tightened, that the government was, even within 2 months, was raising less money. And this happens time and time again. I despair of it. And even when they raise a few more quid, it's the unintended consequences. It's the fiscal drag, the unknown behavioural changes that people say, oh, I won't sell that asset, or I won't do this, or I won't buy that, because the tax is so high. And in the end, and the government ends up getting less money. It really does work that way.
Yeah, I'm not sure that it does. I mean, the logical conclusion to what you're saying is that we should not tax rich people at all for fear of them leaving.
It's not the fear of them leaving. I think this is overblown. The ones that no one's really just very few, I know there's a few hundreds, maybe a few thousands who say they're upping sticks, but really most people not. I'm talking about behaviour of ordinary people, people who've got who haven't got billions, who've got an odd million.
Okay, well, we're not talking about ordinary people here. We're talking about the top 2% in value of homes. Mm-hmm. That's not ordinary.
But you can't tax them more. The unintended consequences, the government will raise less money.
All right. Again, over and over and over again, every single proposal that the government makes or anybody suggests to squeeze just a tiny bit more from those who are, by dint of what you've told me, Nick, trying to or succeeding to avoid the tax that they owe, is impossible. It can't be done. You'll rue the day that you even considered such a thing. Other countries that have happier people, and I know that might seem a superficial thing to say, but what is life if it is not to pursue happiness? Other countries that always top us in the World Happiness Index have higher levels of tax than we do. Interestingly, the countries that tax people the least, 0% in some cases in the UAE, they're right at the bottom of the happiness index. I don't really see that you need any further information. But thanks for pausing from your hard work there, Nick, to explain that to me. I appreciate it. Now, more of your thoughts on this to come, but we're going to be getting the latest out of the Middle East as Israel begins its Gaza City invasion after the news headlines with Daniel Jackson.
The government's taken control of the UK's largest steel company to try to save hundreds of jobs. The High Court has confirmed that Speciality Steel, previously part of Liberty Steel, faces compulsory liquidation. Israel's Prime Minister says he's ordered talks to end the war with Hamas and free the hostages still in Gaza. But Benjamin Netanyahu stressed any conclusion must be acceptable to his country. And a man's been charged with the murder of an ice cream seller near Wembley Stadium. Shahzad Khan, who was 41, was stabbed during an argument on Tuesday night. LBC weather, a largely dry and clear night with a few patches of cloud. Thicker cloud developing from the west in the early hours, a low of 5 degrees.
LBC.
At Lidl, we're making this bank holiday a savvy one. You can save £3 on 18 can packs of Stella Artois and Foster's. And £3 off bottles of Côte de Provence Monoli Rosé. Download Lidl Plus and start saving this bank holiday.
18 plus while stocks last. Excludes Scotland. Terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/LPTV. Offer ends 27th of August.
At TfO, we're opening up more of London for everyone with step-free access. We're continuing to improve accessibility at many of our stations, and now over 200 stations and counting have step-free access, including the entire Elizabeth Line, DLR and all tram stops. That is how we're making the greener way to travel more accessible to all. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
At SSE Energy Solutions, we know businesses are full of different kinds of energy.
Like your fourth coffee of the morning energy.
Your yes, chef energy. And even as per my last email energy. You can bring any energy you like to your business. But at SSE Energy Solutions, we bring simple, affordable energy. Choose SSE Energy Solutions, a different kind of energy.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics, with over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Thousands of Palestinians were told to leave their homes near Gaza City on Wednesday as Israel called up 60,000 reservists for a new ground offensive in Gaza City. Let's talk about this with Chris Doyle. Chris is a commentator on Middle East politics and director of the Council for Arab-British Understanding. Hello, Chris.
Good evening. Hi.
So, what are the Israelis doing then in Gaza now?
This is a very valid question. I think that politically, there are question marks over the agenda of Prime Minister Netanyahu. Is this just bluster? Is this a part of attempting to put pressure on Hamas to surrender, to concede defeat? Or is it actually part of a program of the complete and utter annihilation of Gaza to to try to push ever more Palestinians into the south, into a tiny area, in order that eventually Israel annexes and establishes settlements in Gaza. So it's really hard to tell, because Netanyahu also had to keep together a coalition that's very fractious within Israel. His coalition partners want him to continue these military operations. But actually, across Israel, there's huge opposition to this, because there is a widespread belief that this war has run its course, that a military invasion and occupation of these areas of Gaza City will only endanger the remaining hostages in Gaza, who are supposedly still alive, and that therefore they should be trying to secure a ceasefire deal. A ceasefire deal which Hamas, by all accounts, has now accepted, but the Israeli government has not.
Yeah, the Israeli army is now going to attack Gaza City, which is home to half of the 2.3 million people still in Gaza. Is there anywhere in the Strip that over a million people could reasonably relocate to?
Well, certainly not reasonably. 90% of the population of Gaza have already relocated. Many have done so multiple times. And Gaza City itself has been bombed. Most of the area is already in rubble. So this is not the first time. I mean, if you go down the main street in Gaza, it's smashed. The library, the schools, the mosques. It's all flattened. So there's a sense here is what else is left to bomb? What else is left to hit? And I think this is one of the reasons why so many are questioning what is the real validity of what's going on here? Because, frankly, Israel has won the military end of this conflict, but lost the politics.
I mean, the Israelis say they're calling up 100,000 reservists for this attack. How's that going down with the Israeli population?
Well, many of these reservists have already served multiple times in Gaza. It's been draining on their energies, emotionally, and so forth. There's been a big debate in Israel as to why the Orthodox Jews are not serving in the army. They've been excused reserve duty. So why is this allowed to continue? So I think there's increasing fatigue. It's cost the Israeli economy enormous amounts. Inflation is rising, the debt is rising. It's lost in terms of credit rating. So it's hit Israel in every single way. Of course, that does not compare to what's happened to Palestinians in Gaza, where most people, I think, now see this as a genocide in the making. The process of genocide, atrocities that are going on, the collective starvation of a civilian population, completely unacceptable. But in part, this is to keep Netanyahu's war going, because the moment the guns fall silent, he has to answer his critics as to the major security failure on the 7th of October 2023, the way in which this war has been prosecuted, the really bitter arguments that he's had with the military, with the security services. So he needs a crisis. He needs permanently to have the emergency in play.
The Israelis say there is no genocide and there is no starvation.
Well, which power committing genocide or mass starvation of the civilian population never admits to it? That's never really happened. So, of course, the Israeli authorities deny that. But increasingly, we've seen, for example, Israeli human rights organizations coming out and saying this is genocide. We have seen some or increasingly larger numbers of Israeli public intellectuals, including the well-known author David Grossman, coming out and saying this. And even if they don't accept it as genocide, the acceptance that there are serious crimes against humanity, war crimes being committed, that the images of children starving to death, well over 100 now, is totally unacceptable. And I think that many Israelis are starting to come to that conclusion.
Yeah, Israeli citizens just held a national strike, didn't they? They engaged in street protests in some number over partly the perceived inaction to get the Israeli hostages back. Do you think that the Israeli government's primary objective is the release of the hostages, or does the accusation that they're not focused on that ring true?
Well, most of the Israeli public don't believe that the Netanyahu government is really genuinely putting that as the priority. And I think that they have certainly deviated from that objective. I think the main priority for Netanyahu is the destruction of Hamas. That's how he describes it. I think that Israel may be able to defeat Hamas militarily, but its destruction is not feasible in that the ideology will continue. Many, many young Palestinians have started joining Hamas because they want to resist what's going on. So I think that, yes, I think a lot of Israelis argue that Netanyahu and his government are not really putting the livelihoods of hostages and their family at the top. And remember also, there's an accusation that because many of those who were seized on the 7th of October came from the left of Israeli politics, many were members of the peace movement, that this far-right Israeli government doesn't identify with them at all. So there is this accusation that if they were right-wing, religious, nationalist settlers, that this government would be doing a lot more for them than is the case now.
You mentioned that Hamas proposed a ceasefire, a 60-day truce in exchange for hostages. What have the Israeli government said to that?
Well, we're still waiting to hear their formal response. But thus far, there's been a huge gap between the positions of the two sides. I think the thing that's changed here is that Hamas is accepting a time-limited ceasefire, because until now, Hamas wanted a permanent ceasefire. They wanted a guarantee, including from the Americans, that this would be an end of all military operations. So by accepting a 60-day ceasefire, they're saying, OK, we can envisage a scenario that Israel begins military operations in 2 months' time. That's a change. So the question is Netanyahu willing to accept that? If he does so, he's likely to lose one or two coalition partners that threatens the safety of his coalition. So in order to procure this, he's going to need to bring another political party on board to his coalition, maybe some form of government of national unity. It doesn't look likely. I think that he would rather continue to prosecute the military operations in Gaza to start reoccupying these neighborhoods, to further demolish them and keep the pressure up that way, than secure some sort of tenuous ceasefire deal. He wants the final surrender of Hamas, where Hamas leaders say that they'll leave the Gaza Strip, surrender their weapons, and essentially give up the fight in Gaza.
And yet the French president says that this new offensive will drag the region into permanent war. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that actually there's some truth to this, because you can argue that you win in the short term, that you deal this major blow to Hamas militarily. That's true. But in the long term, you're sowing the seeds of an intergenerational conflict whereby future generations of young Palestinians with nothing to lose, who've seen this series of atrocities, this genocide take place, will want to take on Israel in some form or another. They may take the fight into the West Bank. They may take the fight into other areas or internationally target Israeli targets. So I think that that is really a long-term fear. Instead of bringing this conflict closer to a peaceful conclusion where you can look at the sort of ways in which you can end a conflict that's gone on for over 100 years, instead, you're actually sowing the seeds for decades more, fighting and bitterness and anger.
Macron also said that he would recognise a Palestinian state next month at the UN General Assembly. What effect will that have?
I think it'll have limited effect in terms of what's happening in Gaza. I think that Israel will continue whatever it's doing at that stage. Of course, the United Kingdom looks likely to join France in doing this, as does Australia, as does Malta, maybe some other countries as well. I think where it does change is that you're going to have two permanent members of the Security Council saying that they are prepared to recognize Palestine, that that state of Palestine, born in occupation, is the way to end the conflict, that they are giving sustenance to their position in backing a two-state solution, that there has to be a state, that the Palestinians have that right to self-determination, and they will give it that support. But it's not going to end the current atrocities. Of course, the Israeli government's response to this is to push forward with very aggressive settlement plans to take more and more of the West Bank to prevent any scintilla of a chance of such a state ever coming to an existence. And that is the danger, that actually they can recognize something that is never going to become a reality.
And if the Israelis do capture Gaza City, what are they going to do then?
It's not clear at all. They will go into Gaza, they will smash it up, it'll take several months, it'll exhaust their resources, human and financial. They'll probably turn somewhere else if they wish to continue the conflict, because no doubt the fighting will go on to some other area of the Gaza Strip where they've already fought before. So it's completely unclear. I think the hope of the Israeli leadership is by that stage Hamas in some way would have surrendered. But I think this is unlikely, and that Hamas will want to give the impression that they're continuing the fight, continuing the resistance, that they haven't lost. And even if they have 100 men left standing, they will want to continue to do that. They are very unlikely to just give up.
Very good to talk to you, Chris. Thanks very much for your time. Chris Doyle, commentator on Middle Eastern politics and director of the Council for Arab-British Understanding. You're listening to LBC. We'll take a short break and then back with your thoughts about the prospect of a mansion tax.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast with Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
The Southport murderer, Axel Rudaparna, has won back privileges, including a TV and DVD player, apparently to encourage him to behave. He hurled boiling water at a guard in May. Shoaib Khan is a human rights lawyer.
I'm not sure why it's so newsworthy, to be honest. Luckily, it turned out, you know, I don't think the prison officer was particularly scalded, you know.
He tried to throw boiling water at a prison guard.
Yes.
It doesn't matter whether he was hurt or not. That gives you an indication that this is a violent individual.
But I just don't see why, you know, depriving him of £10 extra for the canteen or...
This is a punishment. Here's the thing. If you act in a violent and disrespectful manner, you get punished for it.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast with Tom Swarbrick. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on your radio, on Global Player and the new LBC app.
At TfL, we're helping to make bus journeys greener. Our entire bus fleet is 100% low or zero emission at the tailpipe, including those for our Superloop routes, helping improve air quality for all. And we'll have a fully zero emission fleet by 2034. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
Here comes Steve, with the satisfied smile of a man who's checking out at midday after a great night's sleep and a delicious unlimited brekkie. See the untamable bedhead hair, and if you look really close, you can see that properly well-rested glow, which can only mean one thing. Last night he slept at Premier Inn. Get better sleep for your money. Premier Inn. Rest easy. Breakfast subject to availability. T's and C's apply.
At SSE Energy Solutions, we know businesses are full of different kinds of energy.
Like your fourth coffee of the morning energy.
Your yes, chef energy. And even, as per my last email, energy. You can bring any energy you like to your business. But at SSE Energy Solutions, we bring simple, affordable energy. Choose SSE Energy Solutions, a different kind of energy.
The holiday party.
park industries in the spotlight after thousands of holiday park homeowners lost what they...
You've heard it in the news. Holiday park homeowners being hit with sudden site fee increases, fake resale promises, and dramatic losses in the value of their holiday homes. The Holiday Park Advice Centre could help you get compensation if you were missold. Contact the Holiday Park Advice Centre today. Text ASSIST to 78900. That's ASSIST to 78900.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Yes, we're talking about this potential mansion tax that the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is considering. Currently, main residences are exempt from capital gains tax. Under the plan said to be under review, higher rate income tax payers would face a levy of 24% on any profit from the sale of their home if it was worth more than £1.5 million, which would make it within the top 2% of the home values in the country. Basic rate taxpayers would face an 18% tax. What do you make of that? Leytonstone. Hello, Robert.
Good evening, Nick. Not a lot. And I like to explain that in the UK, a lot of the investment is by people that come from other countries to invest in the UK. Now, what they do is spend time living in the UK because there's lots of tax, sort of what you call loopholes, but where they don't pay tax on things and they're happy to be in the UK. And if Rachel Reeves starts to close off these opportunities, then for these people who have probably businesses in other countries, as well as the investment that they're doing into the UK and have multiple nationalities, now they spend an average of about 7 months in the UK just so that they qualify to be in the UK for tax purposes. All right. Now, what that means is that they only basically have to give up 1 month a year in the year living in London to take them basically below the 6 months, then they can spend up to 6 months in London without actually being in the UK and paying tax in the UK. So, you know, it only takes a little bit of sacrifice in living in the London of about a month in order to actually not pay that tax in the UK.
But you're talking about a very, very small number of people. You're talking about the super rich. I'm talking about just your average ordinary person who, in the 1960s, bought a house for threepence halfpenny, or it came free with 10 gallons of petrol, and in the meantime, it's exploded in value through nothing that they've done other than sit there and watch it happen.
Yeah, but what they want is for their children to live in the UK, because it is a nice place to live in the UK. So what they have is properties, quite big properties in the UK, and their personal property is very large. And, you know, you're talking a good few million for some of these homes, 20 million homes. And, yeah, you're talking about a small number of people, but it is a small number of people who provide the investment in the UK that provides such huge numbers of jobs in the UK. And you've got to be careful and not frightening these people away. It really doesn't take much to give up 1 month living in the UK.
Right.
They're big numbers, big companies.
Yeah, well, as I say, you're talking about a very, very small number of super rich who can live. It's my opinion that they shouldn't be allowed to just take the money out of a country that has that they have benefited from through the taxation that everybody pays. They shouldn't be able to take all the money that they have accrued through being in a stable society that's paid for by everybody and just squirrel it away and put it on a screen and a empty building and on an island in the middle of the Caribbean. Why should they be allowed to do that? I mean, it just seems to be morally repugnant to me. But thanks for that, Robert. Tiverton. Hello, Margaret.
Hello. Well, I think that we've all got mug written all over our foreheads after that last chap. You know, why? I fully agree with what you just said, that we're just being taken for mugs. What I wanted to say was, I've just sort of listened on and off to this all day, and it's almost like you want a question that goes, OK, we're going to have a mansion tax, and somebody starts fulminating about it, oh, no, 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 and ranting. And you say, have you got a mansion? Well, no. Well, that's all right then. Don't worry, dear. But the thing that got me tonight and today was really to say, these people with lots of money are quite happy to pay school fees, to pay medical fees, to pay for good cars, to pay for luxury goods, but they don't want to pay for infrastructure. They don't want to pay for the roads that their staff drive on. They don't want to contribute to the cogs that make the machine work. And it's almost like there's this big disconnect. Why is there this disconnect? I just don't get it. And whenever you bring up the happiness index, that's exactly, you know, those are the countries where people don't mind to pay their, to take their part in keeping the whole thing going. And I've just been shouting at the radio all day because, and it's the people with no money who are so worrying about this.
Yeah, I think that
won't affect them.
I think that the reason for that is that people dislike the idea of taxing the rich because they have in mind that at some point in the future they will become rich.
They will win the lottery.
Right, but I'm afraid it's vanishingly unlikely that unless you were born rich, you will ever become rich.
Quite.
So I mean, it's almost as though we've been hypnotized into believing this fantasy that our life will be transformed at some point in the future. Yep. So we better not tax our betters because we might become one of those people.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, Margaret.
Thank you.
0345-6060-973. Yeah, I feel that the rich don't want to pay tax because they don't think that they will personally benefit from it. But, you know, if they run a business here, or even if they just run a house, and they don't use the NHS themselves, because, of course, they would go to private hospitals, and they don't use state schools because they'll put their kids into private schools, well, that's fine. But it doesn't mean to say that they don't benefit from the existence of the NHS and state schools, because their staff will use the NHS. The people that work in their factories will have come through state schools. So without those two things, they would have nothing. But because they're disconnected from that, it's as though they think that that money has been wasted because they're not personally benefiting from it. Gravesend. Hello, James.
Oh, hello. Good evening.
Yes, James.
Well, I'm not a wealthy man. In fact, I live month to month, okay? I try to make sure I can got enough to pay the rent and pay my bills. And once I can get that done out in the month, everything's okay until the next month. Okay? So there's no spare capital or anything like that. And I'm not definitely not a multimillionaire or even a millionaire. But I'm not jealous of people who have been successful.
Where did jealousy enter the equation?
Well, I think this is what we're advocating here, is the politics of envy,
The politics of envy. It's excruciating. So the only people that should pay tax are those that can least afford it.
Well, the wealthy do pay tax. From the government's own figures, the wealthy pay tax.
They pay tax on income. They pay capital gains tax at half the rate of earned income. Why on earth should that be?
I tell you what will happen, right? There was a socialist, François Hollande, who was president of France. He brought something similar into France. And what happened? People up sticks and left. Okay?
He brought something similar?
Tax the wealthy. Tax the wealthy. And they left the country. Do you know how long it takes to transfer $100 million out of a bank account?
James, you're talking about a vanishingly few number of people. We're not talking about those people. I'm not talking about Elon Musk. I'm talking about somebody who is sitting in a, what, in London, is an average home. Well, not average. That's is double the price of an average home. Yeah, I'm not talking about Richard Branson, for crying out loud. Those people are few and far between, and they appear to have rules written specifically for them. which aren't for you and me. But that nonsense argument about the politics of envy, God, I mean, you hear it so many times. It's as though somebody has learned this cute phrase that they think will dismiss all arguments, and they just parrot it over and over again. If you are actually going from month to month with nothing to fall back on, then you'd think a sensible person would actually be all for those who have the means to provide more, to actually chip in. But, you know, that's the value of propaganda, I suppose. Sorry I couldn't get to all of your calls on that, but, you know, no doubt more opportunities to talk about this subject to come on LBC. After the news, the GCSE pass rate for English and maths is at its lowest level in a decade. I'll be speaking with a teacher to find out what could be going wrong in our classrooms. Or, after a decade of cuts to our school budgets, is it any surprise that pupils are now left struggling? 0345 6060 973. Ordinarily, Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. This is Nick Abbott, LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, the government's taken control of the UK's third largest steelworks after it collapsed. More than 1,400 people work at Speciality Steel sites in South Yorkshire. The firm used to be part of Liberty Steel. Alan Davies is National Secretary for Steel at the Community Trade Union and told LBC News he's optimistic.
What we have seen is, since the Labour government's taken control, is they've sorted out British Steel. They're now looking to sort out Liberty Steel, and they've got a commitment to do the infrastructure investments and the commitment to buy British-made steel for British large projects. So I think it's positive, to be honest. In my mind, it is.
Benjamin Netanyahu has announced he will approve plans to take over Gaza City and restart ceasefire negotiations. The Israeli military says it started preliminary operations ahead of a ground assault. Chris Doyle, commentator and Middle East politics, told LBC there are questions over the political agenda of the Israeli prime minister.
Is this just bluster? Is this a part of attempting to put pressure on Hamas to surrender? Or is it actually part of a program of the complete and utter annihilation of Gaza to try to push ever more Palestinians into the south, into a tiny area, in order that eventually Israel annexes and establishes settlements in Gaza?
A 26-year-old man's been charged with murder over the death of an ice cream seller who was stabbed in northwest London. 41-year-old Shahzad Khan was killed in Wembley on Tuesday. The UK has seen a record 111,000 asylum applications in the year to June, while the number of migrants housed in hotels has gone up 8% since Labour came to power. Many local authorities are considering challenges after the High Court ruled in favour of Epping Council. One is Labour-run Wirral. Mike Cook lives there.
We have got enough wrong ones of our own. We don't need to be importing any more. If they were coming legally, that's fine. But coming on the boats and then being put into areas where there's schools, there's nurseries, and we know nothing about them, it's a risk to our local area.
Staff on the London Underground have announced plans to strike for a week next month. Members of the RMT union plan to take industrial action in a dispute over pay and conditions from the 5th of September. LBC weather: early sunshine in the south tomorrow, some brief sunny spells in the northwest of England and northeast Scotland, a high of 24 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Daryl Jackson.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Four-fifths of white working-class pupils have fallen short in the two core subjects of maths and English. That's according to the Education Secretary. The GCSE pass rate for English and maths has also hit its lowest level in a decade. Let's talk about this with David James. David James is the education commentator, deputy head of a leading independent school in London, and has also taught in both independent and state schools. Hello, David.
Hi, Nick. Hi.
So why has the pass rate gone down in English and maths?
Well, there are several reasons. I think for this year, the number of students who are retaking the qualifications from last year has accounted for this drop. So you'll see a significant impact on the final results because of so many students retaking it.
What do you think about resits? Because they've been cited as the cause of this high failure rate. What do you think of children resitting exams that they previously failed if the subsequent pass rate is so low?
Well, I'm in two minds about this. I think that, first of all, if they want to do that, then they should be entitled to do it. Some pupils miss out on that grade four by only, a very small amount. It is frustrating for them if they only miss out by 1 or 2%. Other students, though, are quite well adrift of ever getting a pass in English or maths, and the schools or colleges put them through again in the hope that something will happen which will lift them into that pass rate. But they may not be any better prepared for those exams than the previous time they've taken them. So I think at the moment there is with the curriculum review, they're looking at whether to abolish the or get rid of this retake culture. We'll see what happens. I've got questions about that as well, about how successful that might be.
Yes, there's two sides to it, aren't there? It seems something of a waste of time if people are just going to get the same results that they did when they first took the exam. But the other side of it is there could have been some sort of factor which impeded their ability to take that exam in the first place. Yeah. They could have been going through some emotional problems, or could have been anything at all. And so to just have it down to like a one shot and that's going to affect the rest of your life seems somewhat unfair, doesn't it?
It is. I mean, I think there are other factors that play into this as well. If you look behind some of the statistics that the Department for Education released this year, for example, truancy is at an all-time high. 147,500 pupils missed at least half of their lessons in secondary schools last academic year. Suspensions have gone up 21% in 2 years. So this means that a lot of pupils are missing a lot of lessons, and that's having an impact on their final grades. Disruption, poor behavior, these are playing into the decline in certain grades in certain subjects, because if you have a disrupted class, that's going to have an impact on not just the pupils who have been disruptive, but all those who are also going to be affected by that. That all plays out with lowering grades.
And why do you think all that's happening?
Well, there are various theories put forward for this, ranging from those on the right who say it's a decline in authority figures in schools, and then those towards the middle or the left who say that this is the legacy of COVID and the sort of the pupils of this age who have become desocialized or unsocialized as a result of successive lockdowns. It's going to be difficult. I mean, there's probably a mix of both those things, but each school is different. You could go to Michaela School, which I've been to, I've visited. There you had outstanding results today for their GCSEs, and they come up from a very diverse intake with lots of free school meals, and they get brilliant results, but they're very, very strict in the classroom. So that, that's worth taking into account. There are all sorts of reasons for that, including, as you might say, mental health issues, problems at home, and other factors like teachers not being subject specialists in their fields, and so on. So it's always complex, and there's much more behind the headlines with schools than people first think.
One of the things that constantly comes up is the lack of attainment by white working class children. Why do you think that is?
This is in the headlines at the moment. The Secretary of State for Education is saying that they've been neglected, and they've all, they have historically been neglected. It's not just white working class pupils. I think, incredibly, I think, what is it, four-fifths of those white working class pupils who are on free school meals don't get maths and English, and they have become, that's incredible. That statistic is shameful. A lot of time and money and attention has been put into raising achievements amongst black and ethnic minority students, and some argue that as a result of that, those white pupils, working class pupils, from who are on free school meals, have been overlooked or neglected, and we owe it to them to put that level of investment and attention into raising their achievement. It's a national catastrophe that we're not doing it.
Another result that constantly is highlighted is the attainment gap between girls and boys. Why is there one?
Well, that's narrowed, hasn't it, I think, both at A-level and GCSE. Again, there are various reasons put forward by this. Some say that when GCSEs had a significant amount of coursework, which they no longer have, then that favoured girls' way of working, which was much more methodical. And I mean, this is all a generalisation about the sexes, but boys tend to prefer high-stake examinations, less coursework, and last-minute preparation. Again, I generalise. So coursework, some said, favoured girls, and qualifications without coursework favoured boys. So it may be that. It may be that, again, more investment in time and expertise has been put into controlling behaviour in boys. There are those factors to bear in mind as well. I mean, I think it's a good thing. The country suffers massively if boys are constantly underachieving, because those boys are more likely to not go on to further education, not be gainfully employed, and are more likely to commit crime if they don't get the qualifications they need.
What's your opinion of not concentrating on coursework, sort of constant evaluation, and more that sort of one-hit wonder that is an exam? I mean, it sounds, from the way you've put it, that it's almost as though the results are being gerrymandered in order to favour boys.
I don't think that's possible, really, because, you know, the examiners are looking at candidate numbers rather than names. I think what's changed coursework, and will continue to change it in the future, is AI. Numbers of schools are now no longer setting homework for pupils, because they fear that that work will be generated by ChatGPT. So it could be that, irrespective of what we discuss now about coursework, that will be phased out, because it'll just be too difficult to determine that it's actually the student's own work. So it could be that in 5 years' time, all exams will be high stakes, end of course examinations.
But that's not how it works in the real world, is it? It's entirely artificial.
I think if you go to university, my son has just finished university. ChatGPT and the use of AI is endemic at university level. And I would guess that in certain professions which are using AI, that original thinking, the writing, the reasoning, the figuring out things will be done by AI. What we need to instill in the students, going back to English and math, is that they are functionally literate and numerate. And, we do need that. Technology will not get rid of that inventiveness and that human ability to make connections and solve issues. And schools are not, I think schools are too often charged with sorting out the issues of society, you know, to solve the problems of society. Really what we're doing is complicated but also straightforward. We need to educate children in order to go on to succeed at the next stage of their lives. English and maths are foundations for doing that. And examinations are, as we saw with, do you remember, you know, during COVID, the tags, teacher says grades and CAGs, and the grades went through the roof, because it was teachers who were awarding the grades for their students. If you're going to get any objective, rigorous assessment of attainment, you've got to have good exams at the end of those courses.
And do you think it's possible to compare? I mean, is it valid to compare exams across years? Because the exams change, don't they?
What do you mean, across?
Because we're comparing one year's results with another. Is it not possible the exams this year were either more or less difficult than they were last year?
Well, I used to be an examiner, and you know, you would hope that the allocation of grades is an even distribution, you know, so you don't get those huge spikes, you know. So, for example, in my subject, English, if a question is set, which is clearly much too difficult for the cohort taking it, or much too easy, then the grades will be adjusted accordingly. Once the examiners, the distribution of grades, I should say, will be adjusted accordingly. So you don't get, you know, these wild fluctuations that you could get otherwise. So, you know, the grades have come, the number of top grade, or the number of passes have come down from last year, but it's by a very small amount. And I would guess that next year we'll see the same. It'll go down by point something in English and maths, because they're trying to take the grade inflation out of the system that we saw through COVID.
But that's odd, because that rather suggests that the grades that are awarded have been set before the kids even take the exams. You already have an idea of how many people are going to get an A or the top grade, and so you just engineer it so that so many children actually get that, regardless of whether they would have deserved it in another year.
No, that's how it works, We'll know, you can predict with almost complete certainty, that next year's GCSE results and A-level results will be very, very similar, similar distribution of grades as this year. It might be a little bit down, maybe some fluctuations, but nothing significant. You won't get a, you know, as I say, you won't, if everybody failed, to use an extreme example, if they set a paper which was far too difficult for all GCSE students taking English and maths, and everybody failed, then the Secretary of State would have to resign. That's never going to happen, because the papers are quality assured in advance, marking is moderated throughout, and then the grades are awarded post assessment.
Yeah, but do you see my point, that if you have already pre-decided how many people are going to get a certain grade, then you actually can't compare a pupil's attainment from one year to the next, because you are artificially creating the ratios between the various grades.
Well, I don't know if artificial is the right word, but, you know, grade boundaries change, and they go up and down. So, you know, what constitutes a 7 this year, I don't know, maybe 44%, I pluck a figure out of the air. Next year, it may be 42%, in order to keep that distribution of grades relatively stable. So, you know, because schools have to prepare for that, and universities have to, at the end of A-levels, have to also plan ahead that they're not going to see a wipeout of, you know, A-stars and A's in chemistry or maths. They can plan ahead to know realistically, given the size of the cohort, that they're going to get this number of A stars, A's, B's, and C's. Mm. You know, so it is, I suppose, to use your word, it is artificial. But the alternative, having significant fluctuations which nobody can plan for, would probably be bring chaos into the system.
Well, I mean, I'm referring to it because we had bumper A-level results last week, which came with an accusation of grade inflation. And what the regulator Ofqual said was that the bumper results were partly down to this year's children being smarter.
Did they say that?
Yes.
Okay. Well, they're entitled to say that.
Are they?
Actually, I don't know if they are, actually. No, I mean, I think that... you can discount that. I don't think that that would hold any water. They're not smarter than the previous years, and they're not smarter than this year's, and they're probably not smarter than our generations. You know, so that's just misleading. You know, you will get some fluctuations. Like I say, it may be adjusted downwards next year to balance that out. Bear in mind also, there are other factors playing into this as well. Universities are facing serious financial difficulties. They've got a shrinking demographic and far fewer students coming from overseas than they had 5 years ago. So universities have built massive halls of residence and accommodation blocks, and they want them filled. Some of them are facing bankruptcy. So, you know, universities have been, from being in contact with other people in other schools, remarkably accommodating with their offers this year. You know, and it may be that the grade distribution was aware of that market.
So that sounds like kids, regardless of their ability, well, not quite regardless, but well, just to complete the sentence, I'll just go with that. Regardless of their ability, are sort of being given a grade that they might not have achieved the previous year, just in order to feed them into the system.
It's some because grade boundaries change. But I would say, you know, those students who've got A stars, A's, B's, whatever grades, I mean, they deserve their places. You know, it is hard work to do 2 years of A-level chemistry or maths or English or physics. I think a lot of adults who don't know how much work is involved would be astonished at how hard it is to get an A-star at A-level or a grade A. So they fully deserve to go on to those universities. And we do need those students in this country to go on, stay in this country and go on and fill those courses and then, you know, hopefully stay in the country and be productive in their work. So it would be self-defeating if we made A-level so difficult that nobody was reaching those top grades. But there has, you know, I think everybody recognizes that over the last 10 years there has been grade inflation. They introduced a star grade to take some of that heat, the sort of heat out of that top. There were too many students getting A's, so that's why they introduced A stars. So it is a complex process with a load of different factors, schools, universities, employers, all wanting to play a part in something that's become highly politicised.
Very good to talk to you, David. Thanks so much for your time. David James, education commentator, deputy head of a leading independent school in London, and who was also taught in independent and state schools. So there's a lot to talk about there. What do you make of the latest exam results? What do you make of the fact that white working class pupils are still falling short in the two core subjects, that is maths and English? And what do you make of the way in which the grades are doled out? They're decided before the kids even take the exams how many are going to get which grade. 0345 6060 973 LBC.
This is LBC.
At EDF, we don't just encourage you to use less electricity. We actually reward you for it. That's why when you use less during peak times on weekdays, we give you free electricity on Sundays. How you use it is up to you. EDF. Change is in our power. Households who reduce their weekday peak electricity usage by 50% can earn up to 16 hours of free electricity per week, subject to fair usage. For all T's and C's, visit edfenergy.com/r-power.
At Lidl, we're making this bank holiday a savvy one. You can save £3 on 18 can packs of Stella Artois and Foster's and £3 off bottles of Côte de Provence Monalie Rosé. Download Lidl Plus and start saving this bank holiday.
18 plus while stocks last. Excludes Scotland. Terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/LPTV. Offer ends 27th of August.
Get your own UK-based account manager, a beekeeper, for support with PensionBee. Because when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. When investing, your capital is at risk.
The ASA regulates UK ads across all media, including radio, to make sure they stick to the rules. You should be able to trust the ads you hear, whether you love them or hate them. So we're by your side and keeping our ears open, because every little helps. The ASA, keeping ads legal, decent, honest and truthful. Oh, yes.
Leading Britain's conversation, Nick Abbott. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
We are talking about schools, school grades, and why some people do better than others. There's some interesting statistics came out of this. Private schools still fared much better than state schools. About half of those in private schools achieved the highest grades in GCSEs. That is compared to one-fifth of those in comprehensive schools. But grammar schools outperform both of them. 60% of those that go to grammar schools receive the top grades this year. So why would that be? 0345 6060 973. Richmond Park. Hello, Claude.
Oh, hi. Hi, Nick.
Claude.
So I'm not surprised by these results, and ideally I think we are kind of going back to what Theresa May comment made in regards to grammar schools and bringing back grammar schools. So you have to wonder if there's a kind of important innovation for GCSEs with the importance of keeping Shakespeare part of our English subject.
I'm not sure I followed what you just said.
So in regards to GCSE English, I was aware that apparently Shakespeare is going to be taken or being in discussions to be not modern for students, just to give you as one reference.
Yeah.
And then also the importance of grammar schools, which Theresa May was referencing in her time as Prime Minister. She was saying the importance of bringing back grammar schools because she felt that they had an important part of society. So I'm not surprised that grammar schools are outperforming.
Mm. I'm surprised that grammar schools are outperforming private schools, though. It's about half of those who go to private schools achieved the highest grade, but 63% of those that went to grammar schools are doing that. And comprehensives are doing, well, compared to both of those, particularly badly. Only about 20% of entries were awarded top grades from those in comprehensive schools. So they've got a lot of ground to catch up, but I suppose there's small good news in that regard, in that the gap between private and state schools has narrowed a bit. So, and as for Shakespeare, well, it is a bit tough, isn't it? I mean, I absolutely hated it myself. If you've got to consult the notes at the bottom of a page more than you actually read the text, then, I don't know, maybe it wouldn't be so bad to skip that. I mean, I know he's important and all, but I bet kids absolutely hate it today just as much as they did when I was at school. Thanks for that, Claude. 0345 6060 973. This text says, Christina says, my grandson had been telling me he had so many different teachers during and even after COVID. Maths wasn't even the teacher's subject to teach. My grandson expected to pass, but most of his class did not pass maths. Well, the two may be connected. That's extraordinary. Taught maths by someone whose main subject was not maths. Bootle, hello, Sarah.
Hello, Nick.
Sarah.
Nick. Well, talking about the GCSE results, I'm not exactly surprised that state schools are failing the kids royally, to be perfectly honest. I was lucky. I went to both independent and state schools, and I had good parents. Now, I only found out I was dyslexic when I was about 19, just before I went to university. And I went to John Moores, and that was good. They really pushed anyone. Didn't matter. Got your potential. Get it out there. You can do it. That was their motto.
And that was, just to be clear, that was the private school.
No, that was the state school I went to. Okay. I was at prep for a while, and then I was in. Then I went to a high school in Croxteth. But it was in a rough area. Mm-hmm. At the time, it was called Smack City. Oh, believe you and me. Mind that junkie was on the back of every ice cream van. But by the by, I know that the kids who go to the independent schools. My brother went. He got the scholarship. He did really well. But I know kids who go to comprehensive schools. If you do well, you've got to have, the three things got to be in your favour. One, you've got to have parents who will back you and encourage you. The second thing you've got to have is determination within yourself to go, I'm not going to listen to the teachers who say, you're not going to amount to anything, you're rubbish, you're this, you're that, because that's typical of teachers. I speak as somebody who's related to a lot of them. And the other thing is...
Yeah, just to defend teachers, I don't recognise that description, but go on.
But this is the teachers that I've come across in my time.
All right, well, I can't dispute that.
Believe you and me, I've heard many of the tale. And the other thing is, you've got to make sure that the teachers that... You've got to hope and pray that the teachers that you get will encourage you. I mean, you may be lucky, you may get... Some kids go, thank God, at least I've got maybe one, two, even three, if you're very lucky, who will go... Yeah, I see something in you. Let's bring it out. That's if you're lucky. The other thing is, there's a lot of kids who go to comprehensive schools who are on the spectrum and have never been diagnosed. They've got ADHD, ADD, or Asperger's, dyslexia. I mean, I only got found out when I was 19, and I slipped through the cracks at school. If I hadn't have been diagnosed, I wouldn't have got to where I got to. I wouldn't have got to university. I wouldn't have got my A levels. And there's a lot of kids like that who are being denied their education because A, the teachers can't be bothered to notice. They only get, out of 3 years of training for being a teacher, you get maybe 4 hours on knowing how to spot anyone who may be neurodiverse. 9 times out of 10, they don't. The other thing is, as well, you get a lot of teachers who go through these schools who just don't care. There's those who do. But there are those who don't. I mean, I'll give you a good example. My cousin used to be a head teacher down in London. He was at Robert Clack in Dagenham. And when he was appointed, he saw the state of the school and he went, I'm not having this. And he was only from Liverpool. And it was hardly an salubrious place where he lived. And he went, I'm not having these kids being told, oh, you're just going to end up in the scrubs or Holloway or whatever. No, I'm not having that. So he got hold of all the kids.
Kind of doubt that that's what teachers said. But as I said, I can't dispute your personal experience, but that's I don't recognise those descriptions of teachers. But thanks for that, Sarah. 0345 6060 973. Judith says 11 plus to get into grammar school is much harder than entrance exams for private schools. Hence, grammar schools have the brightest children. They are bound to get the best results. I actually wasn't aware that we still did 11 plus. I thought that was in our ancient history. But okay, that does make sense. I mean, if grammar schools get to pick the brightest students, then it therefore follows that they will get the best results. More of your thoughts on this to come. 0345 6060 973. Coming up after the news, Lucy Connolly, the wife of a Conservative councillor, has been released after being jailed for a race hate post. We'll be speaking to a lawyer about that and other issues of what some might call free speech. 11:30 on LBC, the news headlines for Daryl Jackson.
In an effort to save hundreds of jobs, the government's taken control of the UK's third largest steelworks. Speciality Steel, which was part of Liberty Steel, is facing compulsory liquidation following a ruling by the High Court. Benjamin Netanyahu has announced he will approve plans to take over Gaza City and restart ceasefire negotiations. The Israeli military says it started preliminary operations ahead of a ground assault and is now holding the outskirts of the city. A 26-year-old man's been charged with murder over the death of an ice cream seller who was stabbed in northwest London. 41-year-old Shahzad Khan was killed in Wembley on Tuesday. LBC weather, early sunshine in the south tomorrow, some brief sunny spells in the northwest of England and northeast Scotland, a high of 24 degrees.
This is LBC.
At Lidl, we're making this bank holiday a savvy one. You can save £3 on 18 can packs of Stella Artois and Foster's and £3 off bottles of Côte de Provence Monalie Rosé. Download Lidl Plus and start saving this bank holiday.
18 plus while stocks last. Excludes Scotland. Terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/LPTV. Offer ends 27th of August.
£1.49 at McDonald's gets you a mini Oreo McFlurry. £1.49 on a big night out gets you...
Sorry, no trainers.
McDonald's Saver Menu. Actually get your money's worth. From 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary. Fees apply to delivery. Subject to availability.
How are you looking so fresh?
It's my new Samsung Galaxy Watch 8. It's got this thing called Running Coach, which creates custom training plans just for me. Oh, and that's our cue to pick up the pace.
What? This isn't fast enough. Oh.
Smash your fitness goals with a new Galaxy Watch 8. Buy today at Samsung.com. Requires smartphone on Android 11 or above with the latest version of the Samsung Health app.
Managing your business is a big task. To then stay on top of the numbers as well? You're only human. That's why the Intuit QuickBooks AI-powered platform supports your business growth as the number one recommended cloud accounting software. Intuit QuickBooks. Based on a survey of 506 UK accounting professionals. Verify at quickbooks.co.uk/verify.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
A woman who was jailed for stirring up racial hatred in the aftermath of the Southport attack has been released from prison. Let's talk about this with Matthew Scott. Matthew is a criminal barrister at Pump Court Chambers and legal blogger at barristerblogger.com. Good evening, Matthew.
Good evening, Nick.
Well, we're talking about Lucy Connolly. Could you remind us what she did?
Yes, well, she was sent to prison after tweeting on July the 29th, which listeners may recall was the day of those awful murders in Southport when three girls were murdered by Axel Rudakabana. She tweeted later on in the day that she effectively didn't care whether asylum hotels were burnt down. And she was charged with inciting racial hatred. She pleaded guilty to inciting racial hatred, and she received a sentence of 31 months imprisonment.
Now, did she say that she didn't mind if they were set on fire, or that she urged people to set them on fire?
Well, it depends rather on how one interprets her tweet. The actual words of the tweet were perhaps quite important. What she said was, mass deportation now, set fire to all the f***ing hotels full of the bastards, to all I care.
Yeah.
While you're at it, take the treacherous government and politicians with them. I feel physically sick knowing what these families will now have to endure. If that makes me racist, so be it. And it was certainly the view of those advising her in the Crown Court, and indeed the view of the Court of Appeal, that was pretty clear incitement to racial hatred.
And yet others would say that that's her exercising her free speech.
Well, they might. And she could have had a trial if she wanted to, if she had wanted to at the time. But she decided to plead guilty. That's the difficulty that she has. Now, had she gone to trial, the outcome of the trials are always very unpredictable. She might have been acquitted by a jury, which might have been full of people who thought, well, it was done in the heat of the moment. She didn't really mean it. And we're not going to convict her. Equally, she might have been convicted. She would then have had a longer prison sentence than the one that she did in TAC get. She took the decision to plead guilty after legal advice, and she did get some reduction in her sentence. I personally think it was rather too long, her sentence, but I don't think she can complain that she was sent to prison, because that's what the sentencing guidelines said should have happened.
Do you think she was best advised to plead guilty?
I don't know. I'm not privy to exactly what she said. There's a great dispute about what was said between her and her legal advisers, but that was resolved in the Court of Appeal in favour of her legal advisers, who said we told her exactly what she was admitting to, namely that she was inciting serious violence. That took it into top category of the sentencing guidelines with a starting point of 3 years. She says, well, no, I was never told all that, and I pleaded guilty in ignorance. The Court of Appeal actually heard evidence from both her and her solicitor, and they preferred the evidence of the solicitor.
What do you make of the sentencing guidelines on this sort of thing?
I think, broadly speaking, they are sensible. I mean, the problem is for sentencing guidelines. It's no good if one has an offence created by Parliament with a maximum sentence, as in this case, of 7 years imprisonment. One needs to, if one's going to have sentencing guidelines, one needs to set them so that some people do, in fact, go to prison. And they seem to be quite sensibly divided into different categories. In her case, high culpability was one of the categories that is demonstrated by an intention to incite serious violence. That's something she expressly accepted in the Crown Court. And the other category one for harm was that it was a statement which directly encouraged activity which threatened or endangered life. Well, if you say burn the f***ing hotels down, then that one can see why she would have accepted that it came into that category as well. Now, if you're in the top category for both harm and culpability of a sentence of an offence which has a maximum sentence of 7 years, you could hardly complain if the starting point for that sentence is 3 years. It might be considered a bit on the low side, in fact.
Do you think that she was made an example of because the government felt the need to sort of quell the unrest?
I don't think
I know that many people think, oh, well, Keir Starmer said that the court should be tough on rioters, or worse to that effect. Yes, that may have had an effect to some extent in creating an atmosphere in which the courts were very tough on people either actually rioting or associated with rioting. But I don't think judges are going to be influenced to do things which they wouldn't otherwise have done merely by the words of the Prime Minister. I think that's poppycock. I don't think judges require any encouragement at all to crack down hard on offences like this at times of general public disorder. It's happened in the past. I mean, in 2011, that there were riots following, I think, on that occasion, it was the shooting of a man by the police, and there were a lot of riots. There were perhaps, broadly speaking, left-wing riots on that occasion rather than, broadly speaking, right-wing riots, as on this occasion. And then, too, back in 2011, the courts came down very, very hard on rioters very, very quickly. Perhaps social media wasn't quite so much a thing in 2011 as it has become since.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, if you just trawl through social media on any given day, then what Lucy Connolly said would be perhaps mild by comparison with what other people are saying on, you know, a wide variety of different subjects. Do you think that by giving this sentence, the government has sort of raised the bar for the way in which they deal with other people in the future, and sort of open them to charges of hypocrisy, because other people are getting away with at least as bad, if not worse? They just happen to be on different subjects.
Well, two things I'd say to that. First of all, it's not the government doing it, except in the very broadest sense. The prosecutions are brought in the name of the king. But it's not the government doing it. It's the courts doing it and the legal system doing it.
But they set the atmosphere, though, surely.
Well, I don't know about setting the atmosphere. I think the atmosphere perhaps is set by the fact that riots were threatened or taking place. In fact, it's fair to say in Lucy Connolly's case, I don't think any riots actually had happened at the time she made her tweet, in fairness to her. And that was a point that was made on her behalf. But your second point, that other people are getting away with things, yes, I'm sure that's right. But that's the case, I'm afraid, for all crimes. People commit crimes and very often do get away with them. But that doesn't make it hypocritical to prosecute those who can be traced and found guilty.
But what about the other side of it? That if she had said what she did in another circumstance, if the stabbings for these girls had not taken place, if she just felt strongly about, you know, asylum seekers and so on, without the sort of background of disturbance, would she have been so harshly treated in that instance?
No, she wouldn't, because one of the specific aggravating features which is set out in the sentencing guidelines is the timing of the incident. If there is I think the words they use are a particularly sensitive social climate. So absolutely, the fact that it was a particularly sensitive social time did make her sentence longer. There's no doubt about that. I mean, one can't be too harsh on the judges, even if you disagree with the sentence, because the judges are required to apply the sentencing guidelines unless there are wholly exceptional circumstances. No one suggested that the judges were wrong to apply the sentencing guidelines. Indeed, they'd be in breach of the law if they did. And given that she accepted she was in the top category for sentencing, given that clearly there was that particularly sensitive social climate, one might argue, and I personally would argue, that perhaps the judge didn't give enough weight to the mitigating factors as well. But that wouldn't have made a vast difference to the sentence, and it certainly wouldn't have taken it out of the top category.
Just to switch the topic a bit, it's related. What do you make of the Palestine action? It's becoming a bit of a fiasco, because I would imagine that the Prime Minister did not expect so many people to express their support for that organisation, to the point that hundreds of people, you know, disabled, the old, nurses, professors and so on, have been arrested now, somewhat, I would imagine, clogging up an already backlogged system.
Yes, I think that's a very fair point. I mean, technically, the definition of terrorism has been put into law, which could include causing serious criminal damage for a political purpose. That legalistically may be right, but I don't think anyone actually, or not very many people, consider that a terrorist is someone who does even serious criminal damage, like damaging aircraft. I think people think of terrorism as acts which kill or injure people directly. So I think there were grave dangers in describing Palestine Action as a terrorist organisation. I think what you say is right, that arresting hundreds of people and presumably prosecuting now hundreds of people for supporting Palestine Action is going to cause a great deal of trouble in the courts. I think the government have brought that on themselves.
Do you think it's indicative of an increasingly authoritarian government?
I think it's rather cack-handed, perhaps, rather than indicative of authoritarianism. I mean, one could see it in that way. But I suspect that the government may not have anticipated that the reaction would be quite as it was.
There's a lot of talk about two-tier policing and two-tier justice. And I'm reminded of a picture that was published in the newspapers about a week or so ago of a protest outside one of these asylum hotels of a man who had unfurled a rather large poster directly in front of the police, which read, "Kill them all." And the police did nothing about that. That rather does suggest that there is a two-tier response.
Well, I mean, I don't know about that particular incident. From a policing point of view, it's not necessarily very easy when you have a large crowd of people to arrest people for things, offences which may be committed. Sometimes they may have video or of the incident, and people may find the police knocking on their door a few days or weeks later. That's quite common with public order.
It doesn't look good, though, does it? To be carting away people for holding up a sign, to be actually arresting a man with plasticine action written on his T-shirt, and yet doing absolutely nothing to a man who is holding a poster in the police's face which said, "Kill them all" on it.
Well, I agree. I agree. But I haven't seen the video of the incident that you describe. All I'm saying is that in general terms, policing demonstrations is very difficult for the police. And yes, obviously it's ridiculous to arrest a man with a T-shirt saying "Plasticine Action." And obviously something saying "Kill them all" could in many circumstances be regarded as much more serious, or probably is much more serious. I'm not going to criticise the police, though, for not arresting that person. Perhaps they will do it later. Perhaps they haven't been able to identify him. I just don't know.
Maybe they didn't have their reading spectacles on that day.
Or maybe they didn't. Maybe they didn't. From what you say, that sounds rather unlikely. But it's a very difficult thing to police these riots. Well, not that that was necessarily a riot, I think, from what you say. But yeah, it's a difficult thing to police demonstrations.
And just back to Lucy Connolly. She's freed from prison at the automatic release point of her sentence after serving 40%. What happens to her now?
Well, she'll be on licence for the remainder of her sentence.
And what does that mean? Licence?
She will have licence conditions, which, I mean, typically they would require her to notify the probation service of where she's living, probably to keep in touch with probation. That she might well have conditions such as not to go on social media, or certainly not to not to make posts about controversial issues, things of that sort.
Very good to talk to you, Matthew. Thanks so much for your time. Matthew Scott, criminal barrister at Pump Court Chambers and legal blogger at barristerblogger.com. Now, we're going to take a short break, then come back to talking about the GCSE pass rate, which has gone down for the two core subjects, English and maths. And a certain cohort of students have done particularly badly, and that is the white working class pupils. So I wonder why you think that is. 0345 6060 973 LBC.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast with Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
The Southport murderer, Axel Rudapkana, has won back privileges, including a TV and DVD player, apparently to encourage him to behave. He hurled boiling water at a guard in May. Shoaib Khan is a human rights lawyer.
I'm not sure why it's so newsworthy, to be honest. Luckily, it turned out, you know, I don't think the prison officer was particularly scalded, you know.
He tried to throw boiling water at a prison guard.
Yes.
It doesn't matter whether he was hurt or not. That gives you an indication that this is a violent individual.
But I just don't see why, you know, depriving him of £10 extra for the canteen or...
Because it's a punishment. Here's the thing. If you act in a violent and disrespectful manner, you get punished for it.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast with Tom Swarbrick. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on your radio, on Global Player and the new LBC app.
Who's a good human? Alex is. Because today's dog walk with Lulu the Corgi has turned into an off-grid adventure. But wherever Lulu's nose takes her, Alex will always gladly follow. That's why he also chooses Butternut Box for Lulu's meals. Freshly prepared and served straight from the fridge, helping Lulu thrive from nose to tail. Meaning one less trek for Alex as we deliver each box straight to your door. Ready to join thousands of good humans? Go to butternutbox.com to fetch 25% off your first box with code GOODHUMAN. At EDF, we don't just encourage you to use less electricity, we actually reward you for it. That's why, when you use less during peak times on weekdays, we give you free electricity on Sundays. How you use it is up to you. EDF, change is in our power. Households who reduce their weekday peak electricity usage by 50% can earn up to 16 hours of free electricity per week, subject to fair usage. For all T's and C's, visit edfenergy.com/r-power.
The road stretches before you, but there's trouble ahead. Stationary cars. You're faced with the McDonald's side mission. Do you, A, join the ever-growing queue, or B, take the next exit and treat yourself to a glorious Mackey's?
Detouring to McDonald's.
Start your side mission today.
I'm Taz. I've been part of the dental hygiene therapy team here at Darwood & Tanner for nearly 20 years. At Darwood & Tanner, we know the importance of ongoing maintenance and long-term care. This is a crucial part of our dental implant treatments, so you can be sure we're here to keep you smiling for many years to come.
A team of dental experts second to none, armed with the very latest in dental implant knowledge, technology, and techniques. Visit darwoodandtanner.co.uk.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Yes, we're talking about the latest school exam results, the GCSEs. The pass rate down on the two core subjects, maths and English. Girls still doing better than boys, although the gap between them has narrowed a bit. And private schools doing better than state schools, and grammar schools doing better than both of the above. And white working class pupils doing the worst of all, apparently. Marion says, they shove everything into a bell curve. When I did my actuarial exams, you would get a fail grade or a pass. The level was strict, not moved around, depending on who was sitting the exams that particular year. Yeah, that is... It is an odd way of going about things, to my mind, that it is decided ahead of time how many pupils will pass at whatever grade, and then they just shove the pupils into those grades, regardless of whether they would have received them in a previous year. I mean, to take an extreme example, if, for instance, this year's cohort of students were particularly stupid, then it wouldn't affect the number of those that got A star, because they'd just drop the level of A stars in order to get the required number of students passing it. That's my understanding. That seems bizarre, doesn't it? Clapham. Hello, Margaret.
Oh, hi, Nick. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, so I'm going through a real situation at the moment, which is related to GCSE. My nephew had an illness 2 years ago, a very serious illness, TB. The whole family had it. And he recovered, and he had a period of, you know, time off school, and his levels were still really, really good, very, very high. In February this year, he got a very serious relapse of the same condition. And so we sat down with the school and we discussed all the different options, what were available to him, because he couldn't sit the exams because the exams were in May. So he was too unwell to sit them. He's still recovering now. And so the system at schools, if for any reason that you cannot sit your GCSEs, then you cannot go into their sixth form, be it his sixth form or any other school sixth form. So you have to look at the option of colleges, which we've done. And today I have spent the most chaotic, I mean, I've been to these type of things with my own son many years ago, well, 10 years ago, say. So you go into these enrollments and it's chaotic, full of students. There's no time restraint. Everyone just goes in and queues. And we have walked out of there tonight, Nick, with nothing. So he's gone from a student with high levels of sixes and sevens, even with the illness the first time around. And the school are so sympathetic for him, but the system, and I hope people listen to this, doesn't allow the school to keep him.
So he can't just he can't just go back a year and, you know, be the
oldest.
Oh,
no, we asked for that.
Right, okay.
We asked for that. But in this country, they're not that keen on it for whatever reason. They're very unkeen. And although they didn't say no, they did sort of say your options would be better at college, even though he wanted to stay at the sixth form. And it seems to me that, so for example, the criteria is you have to have 5 GCSEs for the sixth form.
Yeah.
And if for any reason that you're not successful, you can drop down to BTEC. But his situation was he couldn't do the exams at all because of the illness. Tuberculosis is very severe.
Yeah.
It affects you for a long period of time. And this is his second time round to have it. So even for the first time, he battled it, and his levels were still very high, Nick, because I go to his progress meetings, you know, where it's called parents meeting, progress meeting.
So what are your options now then?
Exactly.
No, I'm asking, what are your options?
Well, the options were go to college, and we got a letter from the headmaster, the assistant head. He had to do a personal statement. He did an assessment. And there are two different options we were going for. Obviously, as you know, all students up to the age of 18 have to be in full-time education, they're saying. And you have to do your maths and English GCSE because, you know, it's money, money, money. And obviously, they want the students to do it. So he's done no GCSE because of his illness. And so the school can't keep him. And we can't apply to any other sixth form. So we have to go to the colleges. And he's very interested, you know, he's very interested in doing, like, obviously he has to do the English and maths, which is fine.
Yes. But can he not get into one of those colleges then?
Well, this college that we went to today, no.
Right.
There were two different options.
Are there other colleges?
I don't think so, no.
Right, so
so
what is going to happen now? What are your options?
Well, I don't know. Right. This is why I'm ringing you.
Well, I'm afraid I know even less about it than you do, Margaret, but I do wish you and him the very best, and I hope it works out. Thanks for that. Surbiton. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Nick. I'm very proud of my daughter because out of 3,000 girls, they pick 180 for the grammar school she got into. So it's quite obvious when you think about it why they do the best.
Yeah.
You know, the requirements for them to get in academically is far higher than it is for Eton, for example. But with Eton, you obviously, you do to pass exams, but you need the money.
Right? Yes, that's the exam you have to pass, the checkbook exam.
That's the difference. So that's why grammar schools are the best of the best. And the competition to get in there is extraordinary. And, you know, so I'm obviously really proud of my girl for doing that. But my experience was completely different. I come from one of the most impoverished, worst state schools in the south of England. And so I can come from experience of why what has happened is happening. And I can tell you for a fact, these working class schools are run by teachers who are traditionally middle class, upper middle class, and they look down on us.
No, not upper middle class, I wouldn't say. I wouldn't say teachers in state schools are upper middle class, but, you know, let's not get bogged down on that. And there's been a lot of teacher bashing on this show, and I don't think it's justified.
You're not letting me make my point. These teachers would routinely call us names. It was not uncommon for them to call the girls names like Trollops. They didn't know what that meant. What does Trollop mean? We had to look after, you know. Unbelievable. They wouldn't call them names like that. Right. Grammar schools.
I mean, I find it unlikely, but again, I cannot dispute your personal experience, but I'm sure that is not common. I'm going to have to move on, Dave, because, you know, time does not wait. But thanks for that. Sorry I couldn't get on to all of your calls or texts, but, you know, there'll be loads of opportunities to talk about this on LBC in the future. Coming up after the news, one man is campaigning for better access to public toilets, decrying the state of our loos as a national crisis. We are currently only a walk away from Piccadilly Circus, where it's hard to think where the closest public toilets are. Have you ever been caught short? Do you think that something needs to be done to reopen the toilets that we've lost? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midnight, the government's taken control of the UK's third largest steel company to try to save hundreds of jobs. The High Court confirmed that Speciality Steel, previously part of Liberty Steel, faces compulsory liquidation. Well, LBC's Yorkshire correspondent Alex Taylor-Brown has the details.
Around 1,500 people are employed across the two Liberty Steel sites in Rotherham and in Stocksbridge, just outside Sheffield. It's understood an insolvency court now issued a winding-up order for Speciality Steels UK, with the business owing hundreds of millions to creditors.
Israel's Prime Minister says he's ordered talks to end the war with Hamas and free the hostages still in Gaza. But Benjamin Netanyahu stressed any conclusion must be acceptable to his country. In a separate development, the Foreign Office has summoned Israel's ambassador to the UK after plans were approved to effectively cut off the occupied West Bank from East Jerusalem. A man's been charged with the murder of an ice cream seller near Wembley Stadium. Shahzad Khan, who was 41, was stabbed during an argument on Tuesday night. A woman jailed for stirring up racial hatred on the day of the Southport stabbings has been released from prison after serving a third of her sentence. 42-year-old Lucy Connolly, who's the wife of a Conservative councillor, was jailed for 31 months in October. She called for people to set hotels on fire that were housing asylum seekers in a post online in July last year. Well, Tom Slater edits the website Spiked and told LBC, in his view, her release is overdue.
I am very much in the camp that she shouldn't really have been in prison in the first place. Whilst this tweet in particular is really edging up towards, I think, anyone's line where freedom of speech is concerned, this was undoubtedly vile and inflammatory and so on. I think that we shouldn't be putting people in prison for things that they say in the heat of the moment.
Members of the RMT union on the London Underground have announced strikes next month. They'll walk out at different times for 7 days from the 5th of September in a row over pay and conditions. And the GCSE gender gap is the smallest it's been since the year 2000, with boys slowly closing in on the lead set by girls. Nearly 25% of girls achieved at least a grade 7, which used to be known as an A, this year, compared to 19% of boys. LBC weather, early sunshine in the south later, some brief sunny spells in the northwest of England and northeast Scotland, a high of 24 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Daryl Jackson.
This is LBC from Global,
Leading Britain's Conversation with Nick Abbott.
Raymond Martin is Managing Director of the British Toilet Association, a job that takes him all over the country inspecting our loos. He was the subject of an interesting piece in The Guardian today and joins us on the phone now. Hello, Raymond.
Good evening, Nick. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks. So tell us first, please, what is the British Toilet Association?
The British Toilet Association was set up in 1999, and we're really a body that gives advice and guidance on the current, what legislation there is, but particularly on the upgrading of public toilets to make sure they're safe, clean, hygienic, and well-provisioned for all types of user groups, all types of people.
And so what do you look for in a good toilet?
Basically, cleanliness and hygiene is the first thing, but we're looking at things like handrails, sanitary bins, locks, lighting levels, pardon me, hot water, hand dryer. So we're looking for a toilet that you can go into, Nick, and feel refreshed, and go do your business, whatever, wash your hands, clean yourself up, and come back out feeling that you're ready to go back to the shops and back to shopping and spending lots of money.
And not reel out feeling repelled.
Exactly. I mean, the problem is that there's never been any legislation in this country on public toilets. So councils all over the country are really struggling because they're having to spend the money on cleaning the streets, emptying the bins, look after parks and cemeteries and schools. And they have no legal requirement on toilets, but they know they want them. They know they're good. They know people are going to be looking for them and people want to see them. But they just don't have the time for, or don't have the money for keeping them the way they should be.
And what about the number of toilets that are available these days? Have the numbers declined?
Oh, dramatically. We reckon probably in excess of 40%. We have been saying up to 40%, but the government took 20% of all the council budgets way back in 2011, and we started to see the decline coming through 12, 14, 15, 16. And then you have to understand COVID arrived, and of course that closed all the public toilets, and lots and lots of councils have all just said, look, we don't have a legal requirement, we don't have the funding for this. We're going to keep them closer. We're going to reduce the number that we had before. So we've seen quite a massive decline, which we're trying to stop and obviously reverse.
It seems odd that they don't have a legal requirement to provide something that's so basic.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you would call it a human right and a basic requirement for us if we're going out and about, what we call away from home. You know, you're going to need to use the toilet once, twice, maybe more times a day. And particularly when you think there's nearly 14 million people on the disabled register, another 10 million people over the age of 55 who need toilets on an urgent basis, whether it's medical or physical or emotional conditions. And then you add in families with young children, park runners, drivers, delivery people, healthcare workers, et cetera, et cetera. You know, everyone needs a toilet at some point during the day, and some need it more urgently than others. And we can't understand why successive governments have never addressed this.
I mean, I'm sitting in the centre of London, and off the top of my head, I can't think of any public conveniences anywhere near me. So presumably, people are using those that they find in private businesses now, yes?
Many people do. I mean, we go to centre London, you've got a fabulous toilet on the South Bank, the Jubilee. There's one on the embankment beside Embankment Gardens on the other side of the river. There are toilets, and there are a number of toilets which, you know, places like Westminster are doing up. And we're actually part of a London Loo Alliance, and we're looking at toilets around the whole London area. Even we helped Soho put a whole thing together quite recently, and they said that six or seven toilets in that area would bring in £4.5 million a year additional revenue. So toilets actually help to bring in money. It's not just a matter of, as it has been over the last while, Nick, a lot of councils are saying these cost money and we don't have a legal requirement. We don't get funded for them, so we're going to close them. But actually, toilets are completely reverse. They bring in money, they bring in visitors, they bring in footfall, they help traders, they help market traders, they help nightclubs and entertainment and hospitality. And they are an absolute essential.
I mean, I guess that's why large supermarkets and so on, they always provide them, because they don't want their customers to have to leave they want them to stay in the store, and a good way of doing that is to provide them with the facilities they need.
You're absolutely correct. When we talk to the major supermarkets and whatever, they actually come to us and say, do you think we have enough toilets? Do we need more? Because people coming past will come in to use the toilet and then maybe buy something in the store. But those people who are coming in to shop during the day, it keeps them in there, it keeps them fresh, and keeps them using money. So they are a major draw.
What about smaller businesses like cafes and pubs and so on? Do they express their displeasure at people just coming in to use the loo?
Sometimes they do, but I mean, a cafe and restaurants have a thing under building regulations. There is actually a caveat, one small piece of law called Miscellaneous Provisions 20, where it says if you're providing food on your premises and allowing people to consume food, you have to provide a toilet. You have to provide somewhere for them to wash their hands, and you have to keep it clean. So many of them know that, but obviously they don't want teams of people arriving at their door coming in to use the toilet. They don't mind the odd one or two people coming in, you know, in an urgent need, but they can't put up the same way as a public toilet block can do and cover the amount of people that are coming through every day.
Well, I was unaware of that law, and I guess some businesses treat it more serious than others, because yeah. where once we literally spent a penny to go, we're now forced to spend £4.50 for a coffee to get the code that will allow us into the loo on the premises.
That's true in many cases, Nick. The penny that you talk about was introduced in 1851 at the Great Exhibition. That's when the first toilets were, the WC as we know them, were brought in. But a penny back then would have bought you a loaf of bread or a bag of sugar or a penny black stamp. So, we should be probably paying around 145, 120, 145 for the toilet. We're only paying 20p and 40p as it is. But if you're unlucky not to find one of those places, then yes, you're quite right. You have to go and buy a cup of coffee, and that's an expensive toilet visit.
What do you think that of the practice with forcing people to pay to go into what are usually public conveniences? You mentioned one on the South Bank, I do recall that one, but I think it's something like 50p to get in.
It is. It's about 50p, but if you think about it, the cost of rent, the rates, electricity, water, staffing, cleaning, repair, replacement, it's quite a substantial commitment for the councils in that area. They put a lot of money in, I think nearly £750,000 or something, that unit cost. So they've got to recover some of that cost. And saying the cost is ongoing because the electricity and the rent and the rates and the staffing continues to be on. And so what they're trying to do is cover their costs. But as I say, probably we should be paying well over the price of a pound if we compare a penny. So 50 pence is actually still very good value.
What about in non urban settings, places like parks and beaches? Are people having to go to the loo in the absence of provided toilets in hedgerows and up against buildings and places like that?
It's a despicable situation, Nick, and something we've been fighting against and campaigning for such a long time. There are ways. I mean, we're looking at things like what they call mixed-use cubicles and if you got Royal Parks, for example, the buildings that are there selling souvenirs and candy floss and teas and coffee, whatever, those guys put money into the toilets at the back of those premises and such like this to allow people who are using the park to come in and use them. And we're looking and we're working with government at this moment in time. We're talking to Westminster, we're talking to the Secretary of State about how we can fund toilets and find ways. It could be through advertising, in the toilets. Get an advertising revenue, or you could do things like a mixed-use cubicle where you sell a franchise, let that franchise pay a rent, and the rent offsets the cost of the toilets. And we're looking at all sorts of ways that we could make toilets available that aren't going to be costing £2, £3, and £4 in the days to come. We're looking at ways that we can franchise and fund them so that people can use them at a reasonable rate, if not free of charge.
And you did touch on it earlier, but let me ask you this recap. Are there certain groups of people who are particularly affected by a lack of availability of public toilets?
Oh, very much so. There's a number of user groups. People with Crohn's and colitis and IBS, bladder and bowel, the ostomy, people who wear these ostomy bags, wherever now. I think there's a report out recently, 1 in 8 men are going to be subject to prostate cancer and such like, you know, and those. And so you have lots and lots of people who have got very, very urgent needs to go to the toilet. And even you know, young children, families of young children out in the park for the day, daddy toilet, daddy toilet, daddy toilet is the call you hear everywhere. And so those people need toilets on an urgent basis, but they need them to be clean and well kept and looked after so they can use them with comfort.
And in your experience, is that actually happening? Are public toilets that we do still have left, are they kept very well?
The majority, at this point in time, there is no funding, so the answer to that's probably no. Really, they're being opened in the morning, cleaned, and then left all day, maybe closed up in the evening, given a quick clean round. We'd really like to see the toilets being cleaned 2, 3, 4 times a day. But then you're talking about salaried employees and, you know, a cleaner for a day by the time you pay their national insurance and the stamp and pensions or whatever, you're probably looking at £20,000. So if you have to put someone into a toilet to attend it all day long, it's probably going to push the price up to the point where they have to start charging those bigger amounts that we were talking about.
And despite your good work on this, do you think that now they've gone, something approaching 40% of the toilets that we used to have, do you think they'll ever come back?
I really do, Nick, because I see these as essential and vital pieces of infrastructure. In the modern towns and cities around, we, if you remember back some time, we had the Mary Portis report, the death of the high street. And we're seeing more and more high streets where the shops are closing down. There's not enough footfall. There's not enough people coming in. There's not enough spending power. And really, toilets are one of those things which will get people back into the towns, back into the villages. It'll make more people, which will make safer neighbourhoods, safer streets. We'll get the traders back in again. And I mean, you know, the older people, I think was a report out the other day said, by 2030, 25% of the population will be over 65. And the older persons have a £30 billion spending power. People with disabilities, probably a similar £30-35 billion spending power. That money isn't coming into the towns and the cities because there's no toilets, because they can't come in without being discomforted.
Yeah, my most recent encounter with a public toilet was in a park in Wandsworth. Now, Wandsworth Council is quite well to do. I mean, you know, it's a rich area of London. I don't think the council is in want of money, but the toilet in the park, well, it was like something. It was like the toilet in Trainspotting.
Oh, right. dear.
I reeled back out of the door and thought, well, I'll just hang on to it. I'll wait till I get to the pub. So I think that needs your attention. But are there any toilets that you found that, like a good view, are worth a detour?
Well, you have many. You touched on earlier on the big shopping centres, the pub chains, you know, like the Witherspoons pubs, whatever. If you ask some of those people, they'll tell you we keep really good toilets because we know it brings people in and it keeps people here. You know, it's about management, and really the councils at this moment in time, because they've no money, they don't spend any time on it, they don't manage them properly, and that's what we're trying to do with government and with the councils. We're going in and advising them and guiding them and saying, look, if you look after this thing, it will bring you money, it will bring you revenue, it'll bring you people. You'll feel the benefit of this. But when it goes to council, quite often councils just say, when there's no legislation, there's no direct funding, therefore we don't have to do this. Cut services.
And in your discussions with the government, have you come away feeling positive?
Absolutely, Nick. We actually got invited in after 20-something years of banging on the door and whistling through the window and down the chimney. We actually got invited in November by the Secretary of State, and he said, what is the state of the nation? And obviously it's a new government now, and he was absolutely appalled that previous governments had not done anything, in fact had shunned any attempt by us to get them to do something. And he brought us back in May, just before the summer recess, and said it was his intention to look at this here and try and get a grip on the problem, working with the BTA, looking at how we can take our first steps and look at legislation to come in, and obviously in time, hopefully bring in funding to increase these.
Well, on that positive note, thank you very much for your time. That's Raymond Martin, Managing Director at the British Toilet Association. So is this an issue that has affected you? I mean, it's not one of those topics that people generally like talking about, but it's something that you can't do without. I always wondered what cab drivers do. Because you're in a car and you're driving around, let's say, London all day long. Where do you go? I mean, it's not like you can park anywhere very well without buying a ticket. And in London, that would cost, well, that'd be a very expensive trip to the loo. Have toilets closed near you? And if so, has it changed your behaviour? Have you given up on going into the town centre because there just aren't any loos there anymore? Do you resent having to pay to go into a pub or a cafe if you get caught short? And do you think that businesses should be obliged to allow anyone to use them? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
LBC.
So, what are you watching at the moment?
Squid Game, Dad.
Let's watch it together this weekend. That'd be nice. What's it on again?
Netflix. You've got EETV, so you just switch it on.
What season are we up to?
4. That's Stranger Things, Mum.
And what about the kids?
Don't worry, they'll watch Cocomelon for the 100th time.
Switch on Netflix with EETV, plus change up sports and entertainment. It's TV with the ultimate flex for the whole family.
EETV requires EE broadband. Separate 24-month contracts for TV and broadband. Content may vary, terms apply.
Summer's nearly over. It's time to get back to real life. Luckily, Cinch has got all the essentials sorted. And we're not talking about new textbooks. Let's see, the biggest range of cars to buy entirely online? Check. Free 90-day warranty? Sorted. And fat-free Cinch servicing at a Marshall store near you? Absolutely cinched it. Everything you need and not a pencil case in sight. Cinch it for yourself today. Visit cinch.co.uk. Comparison against equivalent retailers. Visit cinch.co.uk/range claim. Terms and exclusions apply.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Yeah, we're talking about public loos or the lack of them. We've lost between 40 and 50%, depending on who you would believe. 40 to 50% of the loos that we used to have at our disposal. And unless there is a change of heart, once they've gone, they're very unlikely to reopen, aren't they? And all of the people that I was talking to Raymond about... you know, people who have a disability of some kind, some sort of medical problem. There's that, but there's also people with young children. I mean, when a kid needs to go, they need to go right now. And if you are stuck and there is nowhere where you are for that to happen, and a baby, of course, that's even worse, then what do you do? And have you also had the opposite of that? That you've been in a restaurant, for instance, and you go to the loo, and there's somebody in there whose job it is to hand you a paper towel and to show you the perfume that's on the counter and to offer you a breath mint, all for a tip, which does seem a bit much if you're buying a meal in the restaurant, doesn't it? Finchley, hello, Sarah.
Hello. It's one of my favourite subjects, in a way, because... It just is. First of all, if everyone that did even the basic minimal of being polite, hygiene-wise, before they left the toilet, there should be no... I mean, you know, we've certainly reduced the awfulness of a lot of public toilets. It's, you know, you understand what I mean?
If people, you know, had the courtesy to flush afterwards would be a good idea.
Yeah, and often the toilet doesn't work, does it? It just doesn't flush. It's, you know, it's sort of semi-broken. I think, you know, if you're disabled, so you have a frame or you need more space, or you have a medical problem of some kind involving, as they say, below the waist, or even if you have both, and, you know, you often need to turn it or urgently, it's awful. And particularly, I've noticed, trains and planes only seem to have two toilets. You're lucky if on a train you get a disabled toilet, but that's often out of order.
Yeah.
But it's impossible. As far as I know, the planes don't have any disabled toilets at all, i.e. that are very big.
I hadn't thought about that. That's true. Yeah, I've never seen one.
And where you've got a confined space for many hours with a hundreds of people and only two toilets.
Yeah.
It creates this thing, because it is a personal thing to go to the loo, but there's often a queue, and I have had seen people sort of rattling at the door, sort of saying, hurry up, which, if you're disabled or have a problem, is dreadful. And often, you know, on the trains and planes, etc., they're out of order. You know, a lot of councils, as you said, have done away with them. I don't think there's been any acknowledgement that people have to go to the toilet.
Yeah, I think it's one of those...
And it's very constricting for people who, as I said, are disabled or have a medical problem,
yeah,
about how they lead their lives, because it's dominated by the fact that they might need a toilet and where do they go, and it's just ridiculous.
Yeah,
I just say, before I forget, that Brent Cross has installed the most wonderful toilets. They're proper rooms. They're not half doors. They're proper solid, so little rooms you go into. And they've got everything automatic and extremely hygienic. And so they're spotless, whatever happens in there. And they're sort of automatic. And I don't know if you've seen them. You put the lid down and then there's heating and water coming out and everything. And they're wonderful. So I just thought I'd give a big up for Brent Cross, who's recently... And there's many of them. There's a whole row of about sort of 18 toilets.
I must say that, well, you know, going to the loo is different for men and women if you're, you know, doing a number one. And my heart does sink a bit when I see that the only thing that is available are those unisex cubicles, because what a man would prefer to do, I'm sure, is not have to queue in a line of people to go into his own room. He would prefer to have a urinal, but they seem to be becoming scarcer in preference to those little rooms.
Yes, and the problem is a lot of toilets, as I've said, as you know, are not solid. They're sort of almost hardboard, and they're three sides. And how do I put this politely? Going for number one is one thing, but doing serious work, as people used to call it, is something different, where you want something solid and you don't want a queue outside.
No, right.
In theory, rattling the door. In practice, often they do actually sort of, you know, I've been in a queue where people are banging on the door.
Yeah, you want to slip in and out surreptitiously and unseen. Yeah. Good to talk to you, Sarah. Thanks for that. Nadia in Hastings says, this loo issue is rather a problem for me. Most mornings I only dare to drink a third of a cup of tea. So many toilets have shut down, leaving me petrified that I need a toilet when I'm out. Whether dog walking or going into the town, it's becoming a bigger and bigger problem. If what your expert says is true, that toilets have pulling power, why don't the shops in towns club together to pay for loos? Well, that's a very good idea. I mean, they do cost a lot, and the upkeep is expensive, but if shops would benefit, and all the evidence seems to imply that they would, then it would pay for itself, surely. Just spread the cost around lots of different shops. Belsize Park. Hello, Judy.
Hello. I'd like to actually reminisce about an amazing toilet, no longer there, obviously, but very close to where you are, the Leicester Square Tube Station, the entrance nearest to the Wyndham Theatre, was like a club for the ladies. The lady that ran it, you went in the main door, there were all the cubicles that were one penny. She had a large area at the side that was spotlessly clean. She had hair grips, safety pins, hand cream, spare tights, spare socks, needles, cottons. She would let you come in from work to change your clothes if you were going out for the evening. She'd keep your work clothes there that you could collect later on.
Really?
On your way home. There was usually a girl sobbing, sitting in the chair next to her, complaining about some row she'd had with her boyfriend. So she was the kind of mother hen to all of us.
Huh.
But this is a very long... This was at the beginning of the 1960s.
Right. Yeah, that was exactly what I had in mind, that it was, be around about then.
But it was amazing. And we used to take flowers in for her, and she seemed to know if it was somebody's birthday, she would sort of sing happy birthday to them. She had biscuits there, she had cake.
she would make cups of tea for people. I mean, it was absolutely extraordinary.
Well, all of the above sounds great, apart from the biscuits and the cake bar. I'm not sure I'd want to eat in a toilet.
No, but it wasn't. The actual toilets were kind of at the side, right. And she had this other room.
Okay.
And also, I don't know whether you know, at Charing Cross, it's going off your topic a little bit, at Charing Cross Station, you could have a bath.
Really?
There were bathrooms there.
Huh.
A really lovely, spotlessly clean, boiling hot water, lovely people running it, enormous soft bath towels handed out. And I'd been there a few times because I worked in the West End. And then for going off it later in the evening, you could go in, change your clothes, have a bath.
Huh. Well, so, that is extraordinary. And I guess that's from a different era.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Yeah, but it's a shame, isn't it, that it's gone?
Well, for the way you describe it, it does sound like a shame.
But yeah. The bathrooms were just as you went into the entrance of Charing Cross Station.
Right. Huh.
No longer there.
No, but what railway stations have done recently, particularly in London in the big stations, is that they've improved their toilet facilities remarkably, and they've also taken away the cost. They're free to go in. So somebody is... like a memo must have gone round, and they must have adhered to the public's demands, because I'd have to say that they are significantly better than they used to be. Yeah. Thanks for that, Judy. I'm sorry I couldn't get to all of your calls on this, but time seems to be speeding up. I'll give one message, and then I'll have to go to the news. Steve says... Toilets are so incredibly important, but are generally so badly used and kept. For some unknown reason, the British people are basically dirty. They don't clean up after using a public toilet, and they don't wash their hands. I live in Japan, and even the toilets at railway stations and in the parks are spotless. Yeah, well, I guess it's incumbent on us to clean up after ourselves. Leave it in the manner to which you would like to find it. Would be a good idea. Now, going to take a break for the news. Then coming up, scientists have noticed, to their surprise, a dramatic slowdown in the melting of Arctic sea ice. I'll be speaking with a climate scientist about that after the news. 12:30 on LBC, the headlines with Daryl Jackson.
The government's taken control of the UK's third largest steel company to try to save hundreds of jobs. The High Court has confirmed that Speciality Steel, previously part of Liberty Steel, faces compulsory liquidation. Israel's Prime Minister says he's ordered talks to end the war with Hamas and free the hostages still in Gaza. But Benjamin Netanyahu stressed any conclusion must be acceptable to his country. And a man's been charged with the murder of an ice cream seller near Wembley Stadium. Shahzad Khan, who was 41, was stabbed during an argument on Tuesday night. LBC weather, early sunshine in the south later. Some brief sunny spells in the northwest of England and northeast Scotland, a high of 24 degrees.
This is LBC.
This summer, deciding between eating, drinking and chatting is over. Thanks to the new Tipple Topper from Waitrose. Our mini charcuterie boards sit on top of your wine glass and come with delicious nibbles, such as Milano salami, Iberico cheese wedges, tangy pickles, olives and crunchy bruschetta bites. Perfect for mingling without juggling plates. Let your summer side out with Waitrose. Selected lines and stores subject to availability.
Train to Peckham, kids in tow, rooftop cinema time.
Six packs of popcorn? I think one will do, Nina.
Ah, clear skies, comfy seats, a talking panda, clearly what we all needed. Okay, everyone's seated, happily doing panda impressions. I wonder when Nan can watch the kids so I can come back with James. Oh, just the two of us.
Download the Southern Railway app to book advanced tickets from only £8 on off-peak journeys. Southern Railway, where every stop is a story. Terms apply, see our website for full details.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott.
The melting of sea ice in the Arctic has apparently slowed dramatically in the last 20 years, with no statistically significant decline in its extent since 2005. Let's talk about this with Dr. Chloe Brimacombe. Dr. Brimacombe is a climate-based scientist at the Royal Meteorological Society. Good evening, Doctor.
Good evening. Yes, surprising findings out today, reviewing Arctic sea ice loss since 1979.
Yeah, so what is going on here then?
So what we've seen in the last 10 to 20 years is a slowdown in the overall Arctic sea ice loss, and this is to do with natural climate variability. So over time, we have seen a decrease in sea ice volume, and it was said previously that we could see sea ice not being in the Arctic Ocean by 2020, but because of natural variability, we see that this is not the case. However, the authors of the study are suggesting that after this pause, which could go on for a decade, they are expecting there to be a faster decline in sea ice. And so this could be quite alarming in the future.
So the pause will be, they expect the pause to be followed by a decline in sea ice that is more rapid than what happened before 2005.
Yes, indeed. So we know that with natural variability, so for example, we saw a pause in the increase in global temperatures in the 2010s, and this was due to natural variability in tropical wetlands, meaning that we saw this pause in global temperature increase. And so this is sort of a similar case where there's natural variability and it's causing this pause in sea ice loss before then, in the case of global temperatures and here, we're likely to see a more rapid decline in sea ice.
People might think, well, you know, you scientists, you got it wrong before, so how can we have any faith in your predictions for the future?
Yes, so I think weather and climate is such a complicated area and we're relying on understanding, but there's a lot of physical basis in weather and climate that goes back hundreds of years now, and this is what our computer models are based upon. And so we're confident with the case of this that multiple models are agreeing that this pause was likely. We could see this sort of pause again in the future, but after a pause, it's likely that we'll see rapid sea ice loss. So we're quite confident this would be the case. But obviously, this doesn't mean that climate change isn't real, that we shouldn't believe in climate change. It just goes to show how complicated our weather system is and why it's so important to actually research different aspects of it.
And it is important to note that it is still melting, the sea ice in the Arctic. It's just melting less quickly. Is that right?
Yes, so it's just not statistically significant. So it's still melting. It's just that overall decline isn't enough to say that we're confident that this is decreasing fast with anthropogenic, so human-induced climate change at the moment. And this is why we're calling it a pause.
And no doubt the usual oily charlatans will point to this isolated fact as proof that climate change doesn't exist, but isn't that a bit like saying that snow in winter is proof that the planet isn't warming?
Yes, there's so many of these examples, you know, so if you have a colder than average winter, people say climate change isn't real. If people see snow, climate change isn't real, you know, and also we can sometimes have rain in deserts and people could say climate change isn't real, but that's just because of chaos in the weather system and why weather is different to climate. So climate is obviously long-term trends, and the long-term trends show us that average temperatures are warming and on average between 1.2 and 1.4 degrees Celsius warmer than pre-industrial levels, so in the 1800s now.
And overall, scientists appear to be surprised that the effects that they predicted would happen in the long term appear to be happening now.
Yes, so, I mean, when you see something on a computer screen, you know, it doesn't seem real, and now we're basically seeing that play out in front of our eyes, and you have to remember that scientists are humans too, so we're all living through this as well. So it's very alarming to see something as catastrophic as a big storm or a heat wave impacting regions and impacting day-to-day lives in a way that we've only seen before on computer screens.
And is nature getting more, not nature, is the weather getting more chaotic, or are we just more alert to the chaos? Because the weather used to be at the end of the news, and now quite often it is the news.
That's a good point. We know that we're seeing more extreme weather events, and this is changing with climate change. So if you imagine climate change basically like a pile of sand, and you push it over, And the tail of that sand is where extreme weather events are. When you push that pile over, you're seeing more of those extreme weather events, like the bit of sand that you've pushed over. So yes, we're seeing more extreme weather events, and also in terms of some of them, they're also impacting more people every time they occur. It is true as well with our connected society that we're probably talking about it, or it's reported a lot more than it was in the past. But we know that's very important, because if we talk about climate change, we talk about how unnormal this is for our society, this helps to promote policymakers to actually know that we all want action on this and do something about it.
Yeah, do you think policymakers are actually attending to this issue as they should?
I think that there's been very difficult geopolitical situation and a lot of things rising on the global agenda, which has unfortunately pushed climate change down in a lot of ways. And I think it's a difficult task, but I think that we really need urgent action on climate change. And because we haven't mitigated our emissions fast enough, we now need investment in adaptation, because it's really impacting day-to-day lives in a way that if we'd had mitigation, it's possible we wouldn't have needed that same level of investment. So that goes to show like how future planning is actually important, because it can ensure, you know, less cost, but also in terms of economically, but also in terms of lives as well.
A stitch in time saved nine.
Basically, yes.
Once a certain tipping point of ice melt is reached, is it that an ice-free Arctic would become inevitable and permanent? And because of that, it would exacerbate the warming effect, because the reflection of the sun's rays would not bounce off the ice, they'd be absorbed by the water.
Yes, exactly. So it's what we call a positive feedback loop. So there's a couple of these, and so these are also termed planetary boundaries. So this is one of them, and we know if this is breached, we'd also see, obviously, large-scale sea level rise, and so coastal regions would be inundated with water. It would change the shape of our coastlines across the world. But also, yes, it would cause an exacerbation of the warming even more because of that reflection effect.
And when you say it would affect the coastlines, can you give us an idea of what would the consequences of an ice-free Arctic be?
I think that a lot of low-lying regions, if we take the UK, so like the Norfolk Moors, and then also down into the south coast, inland, we would lose a large proportion of where people currently live. And around the world, a lot of people live near coastlines. And so these people would have to move as a result of this, and there would be a lot less hospitable land, because it would just be inundated with sea. And that is likely to be the case if we reach that tipping point. So again, it shows why it's important to mitigate climate change emissions. And also, we can't just adapt our way out of this, because that would be quite a lot of land loss for the number of people that live on Earth.
Yeah, London, presumably, would be in danger, because the Thames is, I think it's not the biggest tidal river in the world as far as volume of water is concerned?
Yes, so the tidal range actually goes, I believe, up to Chiswick in London, which is quite far inland. And so, yes, London would be one of the cities that would be at risk of being inundated if we lose the Arctic ice shelf completely.
So, you know, some people are treating it very seriously. Many others are treating it, well, they're saying it's a scam, and, you know, we know who these people are. But the consequences of not containing it or not adapting to it would be greater, probably, than a third world war.
I think it would be, I guess, less controllable by humans if we breached a tipping point than a third world war. So it would have cascading effects across the world, and not just for humans, right? It would be for ecosystems as well, which we're already starting to see. So, yes, it should be as concerning as a world war, if not even more concerning, yeah.
And those effects are already being felt in this country, aren't they? Because farmers have had two terrible years in a row. One, last year, they had so much water that their crops were deluged and they got nothing. This year, it's been completely the opposite. They've had no water at all, with the same result, that they have no crops. So whether you believe in climate change or not, it's going to affect you anyway, because the price of pretty much everything is going to go up.
Yes, so in some ways I say that it's not important if you believe in climate change. What's important is that you want action on the impacts we can actually see, and that, for example, supporting UK farmers so that they can grow resilient crops if there is a deluge or the following year there is no water. In fact, climate change isn't something we should believe in, because it's a fact, it's science, it's not some sort of god. It is existing, and it's to do with long-term trends of... weather in our planet. So I think this is something we need to get our heads around, as it is happening whether you want to believe in it or not.
Very good to talk to you, Doctor. Thanks so much for your time. That's Dr. Chloe Brimacombe, climate scientist based at the Royal Meteorological Society. Now we're going to take a short break, then cross over to Washington, D.C. to talk to LBC's Washington correspondent, Simon Marks.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Clive Bull.
Diane Abbott says she advised Jeremy Corbyn not to set up a new party because small parties won't get anywhere under the current system. Is she right about that?
Clive Bull on LBC.
Get the Monsieur Cuisine for just £299 and save £100 when you click, reserve and collect on the Lidl Plus app from the 21st of August. It weighs, chops, mixes, bakes, roasts. Basically, it does everything for you. Now that's big on quality and always Lidl on price.
Subject to availability, selected stores, T's and C's apply. See lidl.co.uk/lidl-plus-terms. Offer valid 21st of August to the 11th of September.
There are days when you're hungry for McDonald's. Then there are days when you're big arch hungry for McDonald's. You'll get to know the difference. New Big Arch for Big McDonald's hunger. Until 9th of September, from 11 a.m, participating restaurants only, subject to availability.
At Kia, we're excited to announce that the refined new Kia Sportage is available in showrooms now. Secure your test drive today to explore its advanced technology and stylish, sporty design. Order before the 30th of September to get 5.9% APR representative and £1,000 PCP finance deposit contribution. Search the new Kia Sportage to book your test drive. T's and C's apply. Kia Finance.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
Chase is the digital bank that puts you first.
What does that mean?
Well, most people don't bank 9 to 5. That's why Chase customer support is available 24/7.
So I can contact them whenever works best for me.
You've got it. Mm. You can chat to a real person through the app.
That's handy.
And you can always call up to speak with them directly.
Hello. Now we're talking.
Join the UK's number one bank for customer satisfaction. Chase. See what your money can do. 18 plus UK residents. Eligibility applies. Claim based on YouGov UK Banks and Building Societies rankings 2024. Verify at chase.co.uk/YouGov.
On LBC, call 0345 6060 973.
Off to Washington now to talk to LBC's Washington correspondent, Simon Marks. Hello, Simon.
Evening, Nick.
So it appears that Vladimir Putin is less enamoured of Donald Trump than Donald Trump is of Vladimir Putin.
Well, we're in an amazing position tonight. I mean, remember that this time last week, Donald Trump had not yet departed Washington, D.C. to head to Alaska for that all-important summit meeting with Vladimir Putin. He was convinced that there was going to be a breakthrough, and he said that if he didn't secure Vladimir Putin's backing for a ceasefire, or at least got some indication from the Russian leader that he was committed to wrapping the war up, very severe consequences would follow from Russia. For Russia. What we have seen over the course of the last week, since the collapse of that summit last Friday night, the president drifting all weekend last weekend closer into the Kremlin's orbit, European leaders racing here on Monday to try and protect Volodymyr Zelensky from coming in for another White House drubbing. What we've seen all week long from the Russians is a systematic effort to demolish every single claim that Donald Trump has made about the future of this peace process. He said that he's ready to broker a bilateral face-to-face meeting between Putin and Zelensky, and that Zelensky was on board for it, and he believed after the Alaska summit that Putin was on board for it as well. So it was only a matter of time. It was imminent, according to some White House officials, that this meeting between Putin and Zelensky would take place. It's not going to happen. We've seen Russian officials over the last 24 hours not only pour cold water on the idea that a meeting can happen soon. They say there's all sorts of things that have to be arranged before any kind of meeting can take place. But also, even today, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov calling into question Zelensky's legitimacy as Ukrainian president, saying the Russians would have to be very careful about making sure that any agreement that they struck was signed by a legitimate Ukrainian leader, by which they mean that Zelensky, they deem, is not legitimate in power because he cancelled last year's elections in Ukraine, delaying them, of course, because Ukraine was coming under continuing assault by the Russians, as it did again last night, one of the largest barrages of missiles and rockets to rain down on the country, in this case, destroying, among many other things, a US-owned electronics firm in the west of Ukraine. So suddenly today, Donald Trump, having seen all the talk of a Putin-Zelensky meeting disappear, having seen the Russians say that no, actually they've got no interest whatsoever in any boots on the ground conducting peacekeeping operations that come from European countries that are members of NATO. They've ruled that out completely. All of that talk last weekend about Article 5-like language that Witkoff, the president's special envoy, was proclaiming as a breakthrough. All of that is dead as a dodo. Today, suddenly, Donald Trump took to social media to suggest, it appeared that he was suggesting, that perhaps Ukraine should actually now start fighting back. It is very hard, if not impossible, he said, to win a war without attacking an invader's country. It's like a great team in sports that has a fantastic defense, but is not allowed to play offense. And he blamed Joe Biden for that. He said Joe Biden would not let Ukraine fight back. This, of course, was taking place at a time when Donald Trump was telling the country that he was going to terminate all American support for Ukraine. Now he appears to be suggesting that he thinks Ukraine ought to be allowed to fight back and hit Russian territory. He doesn't say that expressly, but he does conclude this message on Truth Social by saying, interesting times ahead. Now, whether that message is designed to put pressure on Vladimir Putin or not is unclear. But if it is designed to put pressure on Vladimir Putin, I think the Russian leader tonight in the Kremlin will just probably pour himself another stiff one.
Yeah, Putin said he isn't interested in meeting Zelensky unless he agrees to Russia's maximalist demands, which presumably is, at the very least, to cede all of the territory that Russia has so far got.
Yes, absolutely. He wants Crimea back. He wants the whole of the Donbass region. He wants Ukraine to agree never to become a member of NATO. And now he wants the peacekeeping operation that European leaders thought they were making some headway on with Donald Trump earlier in the week, including our own prime minister. He wants those peacekeeping operations to be the sole preserve of the United Nations Security Council. It must be the UN Security Council that determines the makeup of peacekeeping operations. That will be the same UN Security Council on which the Kremlin has a veto, one of the permanent five members, just as the UK, the French, the Americans, of course, as well, and the Chinese have vetoes on the Security Council. He's also said through officials this week that the whole idea of peacekeeping operations only being designed to defend Ukraine from possible Russian aggression is wrong, that in fact the peacekeeping operations absolutely need to be designed to defend Russia from Ukrainian aggression. And as a result, he's saying that Russia has to have a seat around the table to discuss architecture of that peacekeeping force. So all of this stuff, all of it has been kicked into the long grass by the Russians. And Vladimir Putin has essentially played Donald Trump completely from the very moment he disembarked from that Russian jet and set foot on American soil 1 week ago on Friday.
Yeah, one of the suggestions from the Russian, well, it wasn't a suggestion, it was like laying down the law, was that they want a peacekeeping force made up of Russian and Chinese troops.
Yeah, well, they want the Russians, they want the Chinese, they definitely want the Hungarians involved, given Vladimir Putin's cozy relationship with Viktor Orban of Hungary. And that's the whole reason why they're promoting this idea of it going to the UN Security Council. By the way, they blamed today Boris Johnson for the reason that the war is still taking place. They say that low-level Ukrainian and Russian officials back in April of 2022 had agreed this idea of moving the entire design of the peacekeeping operation to the United Nations Security Council. And I think it was Lavrov yesterday that claimed it was all the fault of Boris Johnson because he managed to persuade other European allies and the Americans to have absolutely no truck with any of this and the Ukrainians. And the reason why the conflict has continued, Lavrov suggested, since April 2022 is because of Boris Johnson's intervention. So another one on Boris Johnson's record, according to the Russians.
Well, when somebody can locate which skip Boris Johnson is sleeping in, I'm sure he'll take that very badly. It is interesting, no, isn't it, that Trump has seems to have done a 180-degree turn, because he was blaming Ukraine for starting the war. He said that, you know, you shouldn't, you're ill-advised to start a war with a bigger country, which is, of course, the opposite way around to how it is. And now he says that Ukraine should have attacked Russia all along, and it was Joe Biden's fault that they didn't.
Yeah, I mean, Ukraine can't ever win. He has, again this week, as you say, falsely claimed that Ukraine started the war. And now tonight, he's having a go at the Ukrainians for not having fought back sufficiently against the Russians. Now, you've got to wonder in his own mind how he squares any of this stuff. And then you've got, you know, various Trump acolytes or sycophants, depending on your preferred description, fanning out and trying to defend this. I don't know if you heard Sebastian Gorka's interview with Ben Kentish on LBC a couple of days ago on the Drive Time program.
No.
I mean, absolutely refusing point blank to answer a whole series of perfectly reasonable, completely trenchant questions that Ben was putting to him. And yet they still go out there and try and defend a policy that is no longer a policy, a strategy that has been demolished by the Russians in the space of just 1 week.
It is interesting that, as you said before, one of the, well, I don't know whether it's, do you think it was a target to bomb that American business in Ukraine, or was that just an accident?
Well, Zelensky says that he thinks it was definitely a target. I've not seen how the Russians have responded to that. I mean, there were so many targets last night, such a barrage of missiles and rockets, that it's perfectly possible that some could have strayed from their targets. It's also perfectly possible that it was a deliberate strategy by Putin and the Russians to try and continue to sort of goad and tweak Donald Trump and make it clear precisely who owns him at this point.
Now, you being in Washington, D.C., you are, of course, very lucky to have survived this long and still be alive, it being the world's most dangerous city. And I believe Trump is going to have a look at it himself this evening.
He's been out already. We were told, I'm a bit disappointed, I have to tell you, Nick. We were told he was going to do a ride along with the cops and the National Guard and the masked agents that he's brought here to fix a crime wave that actually is not in any sense unprecedented. And indeed, statistics that show violent crime is at a 30-year low in the city. In the event, however, he's not doing a ride along. He went down to Anacostia, which is one of the least affluent neighborhoods in Washington, D.C., and where crime is prevalent, and he addressed a whole group of the National Guard and agents from various federal agencies and pledged that he's going to return life to normal in Washington, even though life is absolutely normal in Washington. But then, Nick, then came the big announcement.
One of the things we're going to be redoing is your parks. I'm very good at grass because I have a lot of golf courses all over the place. I know more about grass than any human being, I think, anywhere in the world. And we're going to be regrassing all of your parks, all brand new sprinkler systems, the best that you can buy. We're going to have all brand new, beautiful grass. You know, like everything else, grass has a life. Do you know that? Grass has a life. You know, we have a life and grass has a life. And the grass here died about 40 years ago.
Did you know grass has a life? Did you know that?
I did know that nobody on Earth knows more about grass than he does.
Nobody. Nobody knows. I'm so excited about the new grass, I can't tell you.
Can you send me that clip? Because that's the very thing that I want to play a lot on my Friday and Saturday night shows.
Already planned, mate. Thank you.
And I do believe that Trump has actually had a win. Quite a major one, actually.
He has had a major win. He's had a major win up in New York, an appeals court there. Remember, of course, that he was fined $500 million, for defrauding various people, engaging in a conspiracy, a business conspiracy, to overinflate the value of his assets in order to attract loans on favorable rates. You know, that huge case that was brought against him by Letitia James, the New York Attorney General. He was fined $500 million. And today, an appeals court sided with Trump, overturned that fine completely, kept the outcome of the trial, the conviction in place, but he can now go and try and appeal against that as well. So he's still officially, you know, a felon, having committed that fraud, but he's got away without having to pay the fine, and they are increasingly confident in Trump world tonight that they're going to be able to overturn the verdict as well on appeal.
Always good to talk to you, Simon. Thanks for that.
Cheers, Nick.
Simon Marks, LBC's Washington correspondent. Now, if you missed any of tonight's show, you can listen back on Catch Up on both Global Player and the new LBC app, where you can read and watch the latest from LBC. You can put your news categories in the order that you want, pause and rewind live radio, and listen to a range of podcasts. If you don't have it, you can get it for free from your app store. The new LBC app is available now. I'll be back tonight with my normal, abnormal show, coming up at 4 on LBC, it's Ian Payne. But first, it's Clyde Ball.
Nick, thank you. Coming up after the news, Diane Abbott says she advised Jeremy Corbyn not to set up a new party because small parties won't get anywhere under our current first-past-the-post voting system. Is she right about that? And meanwhile, a poll suggests 20% would vote for a new left-wing party, and nearly 60% of Labour voters think Starmer needs to turn to the left. What do we make of that? Plus, a new team of litter enforcers in Liverpool will not have a ticket target and will only fine people who are deliberately causing a nuisance. Is litter a problem that actually needs teams of enforcement officers? That and more after the news at 1, next on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, the military spent more than £100 million on a defence system that can shoot down attacking missiles and drones. The new equipment will be part of Sky Sabre, which can intercept precision-guided munitions. Defence leaders say it will help shield the UK troops in the line of fire. Military and defence analyst Sean Bell says it isn't necessarily intended to protect the UK from attack.
It can't hit hypersonic missiles, and it's not capable against ballistic missiles. It's a much more tactical benefit, particularly of providing protection for our British Army forces when they're on the ground.
The Israeli Prime Minister has ordered negotiators to begin immediately to end the war in Gaza. Benjamin Netanyahu says he wants to secure the release of the remaining hostages, but insists the only way to do so is to defeat Hamas. Troops have started to advance on Gaza City as part of a takeover plan. Bosses at the UK's third biggest steelworks say the move to wind up the business is irrational. Speciality Steel, previously part of Liberty Steel, is now under government control after facing compulsory liquidation. Nearly 1,500 people are employed at its plants in South Yorkshire. A man's due in court later, charged with the murder of an ice cream seller near Wembley Stadium. Shahzad Khan, who was 41, was stabbed during an argument on Tuesday night. A study suggests people have a stronger physical reaction to stress if they don't drink enough water. LBC's Tom Harrigan reports.
Experts think men should be having up to 2.5 litres of water a day and women 2 litres. A team at Liverpool John Moores University monitored a group of people who were drinking enough and another who weren't. They were all then invited to a fake job interview and maths test. Both groups had raised heart rates and sweaty palms when they did them. But levels of the stress hormone cortisol were much higher in the one that drank less water. The experts say it might mean people benefit from having a water bottle nearby during stressful periods.
Consumer confidence has hit its highest level this year, driven by improved personal finances. GfK's index increased by 2 points to minus 17 this month following the Bank of England's decision to cut interest rates. But experts have warned there are clouds on the horizon as they predict rises in inflation and unemployment. LBC weather. Early sunshine in the south later today. Some brief sunny spells in the northwest of England and northeast Scotland. A high of 24 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Daryl Jackson.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Clive Bull.
Very good morning to you. I'm Clive Bull. This is LBC. I'm with you between now and four. I'm here on a Friday, Saturday and Sunday morning. And it is unbelievably already Friday morning. So what are we going to be talking about? First of all, the long-awaited, much-anticipated, is it actually going to happen, hasn't even got a name yet, political party launched by Jeremy Corbyn, it's back in the news again. Diane Abbott has been talking about it. There's also been some polling on it as well. Diane Abbott, of course, long-time friend of Jeremy Corbyn, says she advised him not to set up this new party because small parties won't really get anywhere under the current system. And I think she might be right about that. The first-past-the-post system makes it virtually impossible for a small party to ever change anything. So would it be a complete waste of time to vote for any other party other than the main two? Or have they, in fact, had their day? Are we at the point where something really is going to change? We'll talk about that. And there's a poll, by the way, on that subject as well, with 20% of people saying they would vote for a new left-wing party. And 60% of Labour voters saying Keir Starmer needs to turn to the left, and only 2% saying he needs to go more right wing. So there's a message there, but what does it mean for the parties? We'll be talking about that this morning. I'd love your opinion on that. Also, litter. How much does it matter these days? Do you think we still have got a litter problem? It used to be something that was rammed home all the time. Don't drop your litter. There were signs, there were adverts on the TV. Doesn't seem to be the case so much. But there are litter enforcers, and there's a new team of litter enforcers in Liverpool, and they are going to try and clamp down on all sorts of littering nuisances in the city. But they're not going to have a ticket target, so they're only going to fine people who deliberately cause a nuisance. If you accidentally drop something, then maybe they won't worry so much, they won't give you a ticket. But they can give you on-the-spot fines, and it can all add up. So is the litter problem a problem that needs actual teams of enforcement officers? We'll talk about that as well. And later on, you will have heard about the Irish Rail company that are clamping down on loud music. We're going to take a look at etiquette on trains and how rail journeys used to be in the olden days as well. Plus, as you just heard in the news, interesting research on how much water we drink. I wonder how much you do drink. I'm just trying to work out. 2.5 litres, they're saying, is recommended for men. I wonder if that includes everything. Like, is that just pure glasses of water? Because if it is, then I'm nowhere near it. If it includes coffee and tea and anything else that you might put a bit of water in and make, would it include other liquids as well, maybe milk and stuff? I don't know, but if it doesn't, 2.5 litres, that's, who drinks 2.5 litres of just pure water a day? Do you? And do you think you'd feel better if you did? We'll look into that a little bit more closely later on as well. Now, let me remind you that if you hear anything that you want to comment on, you can do that all the way through the programme. Don't wait for a particular moment and think, right, now I'm going to ring in. It's when it's convenient for you, because of the time of night that we're on. If it suits you, then call in now. If it's later on, then call in then. If you can call in, it's better. We're very flexible. If you can call in, great, because we can have a conversation. But if you can't, you can WhatsApp on the same number, 0345 6060 973. You can also text 84850 or talk into an Alexa and say send a comment to LBC, and I will do my best to include all the comments that come in, except for the ones that are not really suitable for reading out, and there are a few of those always as we go through the morning. So one way or another, do get in touch, and on any of those topics, if you hear something somebody says and you want to comment on it, just send a message or get in touch one way or the other. But let's start with Jeremy Corbyn's new party. And I'm saying Jeremy Corbyn, Zara Sultana, and no doubt many others as well. But he's the figurehead because he was the Labour leader. He had a pitch for PM twice. And Diane Abbott's comments as well. And as I say, there is some new polling out as well about how people would vote given the choice. So first of all, Diane Abbott's comments, which are widely covered in the papers this morning. She is, of course, a longtime friend of Jeremy Corbyn. They go way back. And she said that she has advised him against starting up a new party because she thinks it would struggle to make an impression under the current first-past-the-post system. Now, it depends, of course, what you want to achieve. But if somebody was asking me, shall I form a splinter party when you're leaving?